Steve, thanks very much. Hi, everybody. It's us. It's Bill and Wendy. Thrilled that you're here. 312-981-7200 is our phone and text line, as always. We just heard the president speak, and I have to say, in all the times I've ever heard him speak, this seemed to be the most somber I've ever heard him, and rightfully so.
Agreed.
Wasn't he?
Can we take a quick break and then we'll discuss it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because
this is the breaking news show. It seems like this is where news always breaks. And
it's been that way lately.
I'd like to get some good breaking news, though.
Wouldn't that be a nice change of pace?
We'll work on that for today.
All right, so we'll talk a little bit about what we just heard as the president spoke out on yesterday's events in San Bernardino, California, and other things coming your way next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and President Barack Obama spoke just moments ago, and we have all your news here, so no need to turn anywhere else. 312-981-7200. I have a question, because he says, you know, we have to make this not so easy. This can't be commonplace. It can't be an everyday event. How do we do that, Bill?
I don't know.
I mean, it's great to say all this stuff, but...
I don't know.
Well, there are some ways. I mean, you know, there are people have been calling for more background checks on guns. You know,
and these guys had obtained their guns legally. Is that not the news?
Yeah, they did, and that's an interesting question too, because apparently someone else purchased the gun legally and then legally transferred it to these people. So, you know, let's look into that. Let's see how that happens. What I was going to say was, you talked about how. And one of the things is, you know, what's the easy sort of thing that people are talking about now is that, you know, you can be on the no-fly list in the United States, not be allowed to fly in an airline, but you can go to a store and buy a gun.
And how does that make any kind of sense?
So, like, well, hey, that's the sort of thing that everyone should agree that we could look at that.
Now, right.
Again, you know, would that have stopped this situation? Probably not. Certainly not. I mean, there's no indication it would have. But that's one of the things that people are talking about can be done.
And Steve, much like you always hear this about burglars and houses, where if a burglar wants to get in your house, they'll find a way to get in your house. Doesn't that same rule kind of apply to somebody who wants to do something as horrible as yesterday? They're not going to go through all the proper channels to get a gun. They're going to steal a gun. They're going to find a way to obtain a gun.
Right. I think that's probably true. And that's why, you know, you've got Speaker Ryan and others saying we need to do more about mental health in this country and address those issues as well. You know, but to your point, we've had gunmen walk into first grade classrooms.
Yep.
And mow children down.
Yep.
Mow them down.
I know.
And nothing was done, you know. So.
And can I ask, is this, because I had this discussion with my family yesterday, and we're trying to make some kind of sense out of something that just doesn't make sense. And you say to yourself, well, what has to happen? As Steve just pointed out, we've had situations like that, and what happens is you get this flare-up of people who get really angry and say, well, then let's do something about it, and then nothing gets done. Is it because the gun lobby is as strong as they are? Is that what it is?
I mean, you know, there are individual issues, and background checks is one of them, where, you know, there are majorities of Americans who are in favor of legislation that would tighten things up in certain areas.
Yeah.
But they still can't get anywhere in the Congress. And, you know, the people make the argument that that's because of the money and the lobbying, you know, the fact that groups will go after them.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a gun owner. I'm never going to be a gun owner. I do not want a gun in my house.
Yeah.
That said, I hate when people say this, but guns don't kill people. People kill people. That's true.
Guns kill people faster, Wendy.
A lot faster.
I agree.
But see, and here's the other thing, and this just is, I don't know what my opinion is of it, but it's just fascinating to me. We had a terror attack in Paris a few weeks ago, half a world away.
Yeah.
It scared us to death.
Yeah.
We're locking up our borders. We're no longer taking in, you know, the people don't want us to bring in refugees who are poor, orphans or widowed wives or whatever. You know, we're going to lock our door there because we were scared to death by that. And then we have these situations that happen in
California. This guy was born in the United States, wasn't he?
I'm just talking about exactly. In California, in Colorado, in South Carolina, in Newtown, these things happen. And we don't react with near the quickness or unity that we do when something happens in Paris.
Why would that be, Steve?
I don't know. I really don't know.
That's interesting you bring that up, though. You're right.
And Steve, you also brought up yesterday, and I read a story about it earlier, actually last night, about how this year, 2015, there have been more situations like this than there have been days in the year.
If you measure, if you measure a mass shooting as a shooting incident where four people are either killed or injured,
yeah,
there have been more mass shootings than days of the year this year.
That's beyond an epidemic.
Absolutely speechless.
It doesn't make sense, does it? It doesn't. And then at some point you go, well, then how is nothing being done? And I guess one of the easy answers is because what do? You talk about President Obama just said we have to take basic steps towards gun safety, but we can't figure out what those steps are.
No.
We just can't.
A lot of people can think they have figured it out, but they can't implement it. They can't get it passed.
And
can I just give you the number here? So this was from a Washington Post blog. And this was earlier this week, Wendy. There have been 334 days in 2015 and 351 mass shootings so far.
More than one a day.
That honestly astounds me.
I know. It's awful. It's awful. It doesn't make sense that the number would be that high.
And I was hearing about this shooter. The male was on a couple of dating sites.
Right.
One saying he was looking for someone much like himself,
mm-hmm.
Who had his same values. And then he was also on another website looking for an Americanized woman who liked guns. And, you know, it feels like this was carefully thought out and planned. And this was a work in progress that he wanted to do something like this. I mean, I'm very impatient. I couldn't plan anything out like this. This seems so calculated and orchestrated, and I couldn't believe yesterday hearing all the live reports that they were totally gone by the time the cops came and the police showed up in minutes.
Right.
I mean, it just astounds me.
Yeah. It
had to be
horrendous.
So carefully thought out. It's not something you decide, okay, tomorrow here's what I'm going to do.
Well, they're still trying to piece together everything about this. There's still no direct motives. They can't figure out exactly the reason just yet. I'm sure they're doing everything they can. I'm positive they're doing everything they can to go through every kind of email that's been written and website that had been searched from this guy. And is it a girlfriend, Steve, or his wife? I can't remember if they were married or not.
I think they consider themselves married. I don't know if there was a license.
Ceremony.
I don't know.
All right. So
it's so bizarre. And then you wonder, is it, you know, yesterday I asked you, is this terrorism? And your thought was right. San Bernardino is not like a target you would think.
ISIS would never drop a map and say, this is where we have to start in San Bernardino, California.
Exactly.
Nobody would do that.
But then now, is it someone who isn't maybe directly related to ISIS, but believes in them and supports them that takes their own mission? That's my worry.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, card-carrying members of ISIS, but they want to carry on their work.
Yeah.
That is what scares me.
Yeah. It's frightening.
I know.
It's awful. All right, we'll take a quick break. Steve has the news and a lot of things on today's show. Stay here. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Oh, holy night, this song does it to me. I start tingling from the top of my head to the bottom of my toes.
Sure.
Goosebumps Central, Gary Hoey, you're hearing him play, and he's in the studio with us right now. How are you, Gary Hoey?
I'm very well. How are you guys?
Excited to meet you.
Thanks,
we've always,
man.
Both Wendy and I have always talked about you and wanted to meet you, and here you are.
Well, I'm so glad we got to meet, and Wendy, you're like at the leather jacket.
I don't. You know what? We're talking to Zuzu today, and she's so wholesome and wonderful from It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm-hmm.
Carolyn Jones.
I can't. Carolyn
remember.
Grimes.
Grimes. Sorry, yeah, Carolyn Jones was Morticia Adams.
Right.
She's coming in later too.
She will not be with us.
Okay.
She is no longer with us.
So you know, Carolyn Grimes is so like sweet and demure that I wanted to leather it up today, not knowing you were going to come in the studio. So
and I came in with my leather jacket.
we could be twins.
We should start a band.
All right. Well, speaking of a band, Ozzy Osbourne, Randy Rhoads goes away, and you auditioned to play with Ozzy, and it's kind of maybe good that you didn't get the gig.
I don't know. I mean, it was definitely a great experience, you know, because I was a huge fan of Ozzy and Black Sabbath growing up. But getting the audition, you know, it led me to going to Los Angeles to do the audition. You know, Ozzy flew me out. And even though I didn't get the gig, it just brought me to that place. It gave me a lot of confidence, you know, in myself, because he noticed me and said, you know, Gary, I really need to have you come out to L.A. and play some guitar, man. So I said, Sharon, what did he say? And Sharon Osbourne said, you didn't get the gig, but you sound pretty good. You moved to L.A.
Oh.
So I went home and I packed up a U-Haul and I moved to Los Angeles and I signed with Warner Brothers Records. So I thank you, Ozzy. Thank
yeah,
you so
he did it in an indirect way.
He did do it.
Yep.
Are you okay with the I hear surf rock. You're good with that term, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I grew up, you know, playing. I lived on the East Coast, but I loved surf music. I didn't even know what it was. I had my mom go buy me the 45 record of Surfer Bird and Mizzaloo and all that stuff. I don't have my guitars on, but I used to play like, you know. You know, that kind of stuff.
Beautiful.
But I grew up on the East Coast, and I loved surf music, and I scored Endless Summer too, the soundtrack, which became kind of like the Bible to the surf community. And I got the surf guy, and I'm the Christmas guy too. So,
well, how did the Christmas guy start? I mean, how did you want to do Christmas music, or I mean, what prompted you to do that?
You know, a lot of it was my mom. You know, I grew up in New England and, like Chicago, you know, cold winters, you know, and it's that time where you get in the house and you sit by the tree, and we had a fireplace and hot chocolate. And my mother would, I remember she'd have the Elvis record playing, and it would always seem to be skipping on Blue Christmas, and the vinyl record would be like, oh, blue. And I say, Mom, the record's skipping. Shut up. Get me a Pall Mall and a Schlitz. Be quiet. And that was the start of our Christmas. So, she said, Gary, you need to make a nice Christmas record. And I was playing rock guitar. I'm saying, Mom, there's enough nice Christmas records out there. I need to do something that's going to rock. And to be honest with you, I didn't even know back in the day when I was deciding to do it that it was something new. I really didn't know. In 1995, I took my guitar and I'm like, well, what if we did, you know, Mr. Grinch? You know. You know, and at the time,
wow. Isn't that awesome?
That sounds so good.
I had to listen to the TV. You know, there wasn't even a single of
right.
it. And then I'm like, well, what would it sound like if I went to Metallica's house for Christmas? And it's like, you know, and then I do the Grinch.
Right.
And then I thought, well, what if I tune my guitar down? And I started going. You know, and putting a heavy riff in between, or I take a melody like, you know. And then I would go. It was like good and evil just meeting in the middle. So that's kind of how it started.
Do you have to get, like, for a song like Mr. Grinch, do you have to secure the rights to play your version of it, or are they okay with it?
They're okay. What you have to do is you just have to credit the writer and the publisher. When you release the record, you have to make sure they're labeled and they're credited, and then they make the money.
They get a cut of it.
They do. And let me tell you, I've paid them a lot of money, man. Yeah. Whoever wrote Jingle Bell Rock and Crockin' Around the Christmas Tree, they've got some checks. Because we've sold hundreds of thousands of copies in the last 20 years.
Well, that's it. Ho, ho, ho-y. 20 years ago.
20 years ago. It started in a bedroom on an 8-track. I literally recorded it on 8 tracks, the first album. I did not use one more track than 8. I did it in my bedroom.
So when you analyze
the
huge success that that album had, Ho Ho Hoey, for 20 years, in your head, why is it as popular as it is, do you think?
I'll tell you one of the reasons, because I really tried so hard to make the arrangements really well, really good. You know, I took my time to really listen to the melodies and make sure that I had them exactly right. I would go find the sheet music and I would, you know, like a little subtle thing, like if you listen to Greensleeves, you know. If I play Greensleeves, I can play the melody, right? Everybody knows this melody. So I was like, well, what if I put some delay on my guitar and go. And kind of sneak everybody into the song
right.
and then go.
Right.
So what I did is I tried to take the productions and make them interesting and make the melodies, you know, pure and something different. Like, if you listen to my version of the first Noel, think of the first Boston album.
All right.
And listen to that. And think of the very first Boston record. The production sounds like Boston.
It does. Yeah, it does. Yep.
So that's why I think the songs have stood the test of time.
Sure.
You know, and why a lot of families tell me they decorate the tree, they decorate, you know, they cook the turkey to my music. I mean, that all that stuff, it means so much to me that I'm a part of people's holiday.
Every year at our house.
You know, it really means the world to me. I got to tell you, I never thought it would turn into what it's
Wendy has
to.
The guys from Anthrax come over for Christmas every year and they listen to your album.
Can I tell you, I have two albums. I have my 16-year-old loves to play guitar. So we listen to Ho Ho Hoey and we listen to Phil Spector's special Christmas with Ronnie Spector and all the Motown girls.
Oh, wow.
So I kind of cheat on you a little with
them. That's hip, though. That's some hip stuff right there, man. Well, I'm happy to be a part of it. You know, I still love all the old Christmas music. I still love Bing Crosby and Johnny Mathis.
Yeah, good.
I love it all. You know, Elvis, Christmas, Kenny G, I don't know.
Oh, really? Kenny G should not be part of the
He's
musical
a brilliant
world.
Musician and everything. I know he can hold a note for a long time.
A long time?
No, I'm serious. He's awesome. His Christmas records are really good. It's really good. But
see, I'm not into that. And people that are?
Yeah, it's not my thing, but I definitely think he's awesome. But, you know, for me, there's a lot of great Christmas music out there. And ever since I've done it, you know, now there's a reggae Christmas.
But you were the first.
I was actually the first, man.
You were before Brian Setzer and his orchestra. The Trans-Siberian.
I was even before them. I was actually the first guy. Because when it hit the radio, people were just like, what is this? And all you lovely DJs, luckily, were saying, Gary, we're going to use your music, like, coming in and out of commercials and bumper music. And that's where it started.
Yeah.
And people would call up and go, what was that weird version of the 12 Days of Christmas that you just played? And it just kind of took on its own life. And after I did the first album, people just kept saying, you got to do another one. And now we have a double disc, the complete collection that has like almost 40 songs.
Oh, wow.
And talk about your new Blue Elan.
Yes, I got a call about a children's charity, Blue Elan Christmas. It's on my website, GaryHoey.com. Basically, it's to help kids that are not doing so well coming out of foster homes, kids that are just in trouble, and all the money goes to the Alliance for Children. So they said, do you have a track, Gary, that you haven't released? And I said, man, I was recording this version of Oh Holy Night, but I never released it. So I went and dug it up, and I remixed it a little bit, and I gave them the track, you know, carte blanche, no charge, here you go. And all the money is going toward the Children's Alliance group.
That's so nice of you to do.
Oh, my pleasure, man. I got to tell you, we have done in the last 20 years, we have filled tractor trailer trucks full of food. We have given more kids toys. We have given the veterans clothing. I mean, I've done literally 10,000 charity events in the last 20 years.
So good.
To think about how much more my music has gone into beyond just playing music for me. I've made some money on it, but you know what? It ain't about the money. I never did it for the money. I did it because I loved it. And that's the bottom line.
That's so nice. That's so nice. Always instrumentals, right? Has there ever been anybody singing along to any of these?
You know, most of the stuff I've ever done with the Christmas is all instrumental. There's one version I had a guy do a little bit of a rap on one of the songs, but pretty much it's all instrumental.
Yeah.
And my daughter says ho, ho, ho in the beginning of the song.
But
other than that, it's like all just instrumental. My new blues record coming out in the new year, and my last blues record, I am singing on those records. I do sing, and I'll sing tonight at the Arcata when I play live.
Okay. Yes, oshows.com. Some tickets are still available. Arcata Theater. It's a beautiful venue. I saw Ronnie Spector there, too. I'm going to go again this year.
Nice.
It's this whole Christmas thing. I cook my turkey, and then it's Christmas music.
You know what?
The
it's a beautiful
season.
Venue. I love the venue. It's out in the burbs, but come out to the burbs.
It's worth
come
the
and
trip.
See us. There's a Starbucks right downstairs, so I always get my coffee.
And there's antiquing nearby, Gary.
Yes.
You can go get yourself
so get there
an old
early.
Couch.
Then, you know, go headbanging with me.
We're going to take a quick break, and some listeners want to talk to you. 312-981-7200. We're getting into the Christmas spirit, rock and roll style, with Gary Hoey here on 720 WGN. Everybody is texting us, 312-981-7200. Who's on the air with you? Oh, this is awesome. Can he play the Jake Arrieta song?
Oh,
which is Alouetta. Can you play Alouetta?
No, I don't Alouetta? Know Alouetta.
All right.
Oh, man.
Because Bill did a song for Cubs pitcher Jake Arrieta, and I got to be honest with you, I'm glad you can't do it right now.
I don't know it off the top of my head. I'd probably ruin it if I tried to play it, so I don't want to butcher
it
on you.
The lyrics.
I'm going to do it at the American Music Awards this year,
no,
Gary.
Not.
You can watch it when they broadcast
okay,
that.
Now I know why the connection to the song. Okay, I'll be watching.
All right, your guitar is on. Everybody wants to know who you are. How many CDs do you have out? Where do we find them? Where do we see them? You can go to the Arcata Theater tonight.
Yes.
You can go to oshows.com for more information.
Or GaryHowie.com.
Absolutely, and that's where you can find out all the information about all your CDs, including Blue Elan, which will benefit the...
It's going to be the Alliance for Children.
That's it.
And my last name is Hoey. It's H-O-E-Y, because sometimes people mess up the spelling. It's not. It's just like Joey with an H, but I did not name my son Joey.
Oh, Joey
and
Hoey would have been a
great name. My daughter Zoe.
Or Chloe.
Oh, Chloe. Hi, I'm Chloe Hoey. Chloe Hoey, are you in class? I'm here, Chloe Hoey. I said to my daughter, I could have named you Zoe. She goes, that would have been cool. Do you like
and
when,
cruel.
Do you like when parents name their kids like weird names? Do you think that's weird?
No, not at all.
I've got a Michael and a Dylan, so I'm pretty normal.
Well, like, I think it's weird when parents give their kids like a totally super strange name, and then they do a super weird spelling to it.
Right.
On
yeah.
top of that, I don't know. I think it's a curse to the kid. I'm sorry, man.
Although I did grow up with a guy named Scott Scott.
Scott Scott.
And every time I bring this up, he calls in. But it, his name is Scott Scott.
Scott
now,
Scott.
Why would his parents do that to him?
That's kind of weird. Scott Scott.
All right, Gary Hoey's here. You want to try your guitar? We made a few little adjustments.
Yes. How are we doing now? Is it sounding okay?
Beautiful. Stunning.
Sounds beautiful.
Yep.
Oh, that is gorgeous. All right, Brian wants to talk to you. He called 312-981-7200. Brian, what do you got to say to Gary Hoey?
Bill, Wendy, love your show. Listen every day. Gary Hoey, it's an honor to talk to you. I was at your show at Ron's Place, the Arcata, last year. Not only did you tear the roof off the place, I got to tell you, after following you for 25 years, I know the secret to your success.
Which
is
what?
It's the fact that you treat every one of your fans like your best buddy. You waited till the last person was out of the theater with your autograph and had a conversation with them. I'm telling you, you're a great guy. Can't wait to see you again tonight, Gary.
Oh, thank you so much, man. That means a lot. I really appreciate it. I look forward to seeing you tonight, too. You know what? I grew up, I was a big fan. You know, I had so many musicians that I admired, you know, when I was a kid. And I remember one time standing in line for like 2 hours to meet one of my heroes. With a picture and everything, and I just kept thinking, what am I going to say? You know, what am I going to tell him? What am I going to do? I was
right.
just so nervous. And then when I walked up, he didn't even look up at me.
That's why you're not saying who it is, right?
He scribbled something on a piece of paper and just shoved it at me, and didn't even ask me my name. And I just was devastated. And I said, you know what? If I'm ever famous, if anybody ever cares about me or ever wants my autograph or a picture with me, or anybody ever gives me the time of day, I will never ever do that to a fan. To this day, and I've always just said, you know, you can change someone's life in 30 seconds.
Right.
You know, 40 seconds. You can talk to a kid and give him inspiration for his life forever.
It's a Christmas miracle.
It is a Christmas miracle.
God bless us.
Was it Paul Anka?
Thank you, Brian, so much.
Paul Anka?
Another question from Jim, who's on the line. Hi, Jim.
Paul Anka. It's Johnny Mathis.
Hey,
Johnny
there, Gary. Mathis. It is an absolute honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
My question to you is, what was the reason behind you did Hocus Pocus? Was it an influence? Was it... just what was that? How come you picked that song to redo?
You know, it's funny you ask that. I've had a lot of happy accidents happen in my life. Ho, 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 he was one of them. I never thought it would turn into this. Same thing with Hocus Pocus. I was recording an By Focus, which was a song from the 70s.
For Zoe Hoey.
Yeah, and I recorded my very first Christmas album for Warner Brothers. I mean, my first studio record. And we were almost at the end of the record. My manager said, you know, we should do one cover song.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, what would be like a song you played in the garage when you were a kid growing up that, you know, you just thought was cool? So I started playing this riff, and I go, remember this riff? You know, and it had this...
Did you add the...
Yeah. And the original song had this guy yodeling in it when he was like... And I'm like, I can't do yodeling. So I took the wah-wah pedal, and I mimicked it with the wah-wah pedal. And that was kind of it. We just did it as a fun little thing. And then in the middle of the song, I just did a riff by Ted Nugent. I started going... And I did like just a quote of Stranglehold, just like one time. And then that just caused it even more for people to talk about the song. It was just one of those songs that we did for fun. And then
it took off.
We just didn't really have any clue it would...
It's the yodeling. People love yodeling.
that is the first song I heard you do years ago.
Thank you, man.
You've been there ever since, and you're the only guy that I don't have a signature on one of my guitars. I'm a guitar collector, and I got Satriani, all those guys. But you, I've never met you. I wish I could make it to the show tonight. And there's only one guy that comes close to you, and his name is Lydon Moon. And he's out of Kenosha, Wisconsin.
I know Lydon. Lydon's a friend of mine. I know Lydon Moon. He's a great guitar player, actually. I wanted to say thank you, man, for all the years of support. And, you know, Hocus Pocus did put me on the map. It did kind of get me out there. And sometimes that's what you need, is that one thing to get you out there. And sometimes you just need a hand up. You know, there's a lot of young musicians out there. They just need that one hand up to give them a break. And that's what it takes.
Yep.
Thanks so much, Jim. That's what I'm hoping my son, remember Michael McInerney, because someday he'll be huge.
I believe you. And tell him he can email me anytime, GaryHoey.com. He can send me emails right through the website if he ever has any music questions.
Oh, my God.
I read all my emails. I read all my tweets, my Facebook. I'm on it all the time. I answer fans personally, directly.
Look at him.
So
try to be a nicer guy in the year 2016, Gary, please. If you could just step it up just a little bit.
Go to oshows.com or GaryHoey.com. Arcata Theater tonight.
Tonight. Yeah.
A very quick little Blue Christmas before we get out of here, because we got a break for news, but I got to hear it. And he will do it.
Can I play my slide?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I will yodel during the song for you.
Ba 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 ba.
Are we gonna add yodeling to it?
Yeah, no, every song should have yodeling in it.
A little Blue Christmas for your holiday cheer. God bless you, everyone.
How about that? If we had lighters, Gary, they'd be up in the air right now. We're not allowed to have them in the studio.
Gary Hoey, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. It was
awesome.
Have
a great holiday. Quick break, then some news and a lot more show coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
He knows which movies make you laugh and which ones make you cry. If you love films, then Dean's your guy. So grab yourself some popcorn. He will not talk about hard porn.
Well, he might if you twist his
arm. He wants to.
Arm?
We keep telling him not to, but he wants to. Hi, Dean.
I'm going to save it for Christmas. I'm going to do a huge Christmas porn special.
What are you going to put in my stocking?
Oh, I think you just answered your own question.
Right, you did. Yes, you did. Dean and I have exchanged a couple of texts back and forth over the last few days. He's in Los Angeles, and Dean is, or was, on the set of the old Johnny Carson Tonight Show.
Oh,
there's pictures crazy up on Facebook. What was that like, Dean? Was that exciting?
It's crazy. It's crazy. I'm not in Los Angeles anymore. You're going to freak out when you hear where I am. I'll tell you in a second.
All right.
I go to beautiful downtown Burbank, as Johnny Carson used to call it. The old NBC studios there. It's not NBC anymore. It's a production lot. It's called the Burbank Studio. The Johnny Carson studio is, you know, still pretty much intact. I mean, the set is obviously gone, the desk and all that, but the seats where the audience sat, all there. And Johnny Carson's nephew, who runs the Carson estate now, you know, kind of showed me, this is where Doc stood, this is where Ed stood, this is where Johnny did the monologue. You know, this is the hallway that Johnny walked, you know, every night before this is where the curtains were when he would step out of the curtains. And it was, I was a kid in a candy store.
Sure.
At that place. It was absolutely unbelievable to be in maybe one of the most historic spots in broadcast history.
How jealous are you, Bill?
I'm so jealous. There's a picture that Dean posted on Facebook where he's in the audience, and it just reminded me of the thousands of times that they would go out into the audience to play Stump the Band or one of those games, right. And there you were.
Right. You know what I found out about Stump the Band? Jeff
Carson.
You told me the story that they would do Stump the Band whenever a guest canceled.
Oh, but really?
The only reason that Stump the Band existed. That if, you know, somebody was supposed to be there and suddenly they had 10 minutes to fill,
yeah,
they would do, hey, let's do Stump the Band. And, you know, there were always people in the audience who had stupid songs to play the game. But how about that? Like, one of the most iconic parts of The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson was just a time killer.
Yeah, it was. Now, here's what needs to be asked. You work on an almost daily basis in the studio at WGN where Bozo Circus was taped every day or shown every day. And people always say the same thing. It's so much smaller in real life when you're in that studio, the Bozo studio. Yeah. Is it like that with Johnny Carson's studio also?
Yeah, definitely. It was much, much smaller. And, you know, everything, and it was empty, you know, all the props and everything was gone. So I can imagine how much smaller it seemed even when there was a band there and furniture and, you know, everything else that was there. But it was pretty cool. So I did that on Tuesday, I think.
Yeah.
And then yesterday I went to San Diego. I drove to San Diego and I met up with Joan Embry.
From the San Diego Zoo.
How cool is that? Now I'm impressed.
She's not with the zoo anymore. She's kind of semi-retired, but she has a ranch just outside of San Diego where she has really like 100 acres or something, and she keeps like sort of this wildlife conservatory of animals and things. You know, you're sitting there talking to her and a porcupine walks by or, you know, a zebra.
I bet she's friends with Tippi Hedren.
Probably.
She probably is, and Betty White, I would imagine.
Yeah.
They're all animal, you know, people. But she couldn't have been nicer. We had a fantastic interview with her. You're seeing, you know, the sort of the theme of my week has all been very Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
Because we're working on some stories for the launch of the Johnny Carson Show on Antenna TV, our, you know, nostalgia national cable channel. Where, you know, we show, you know, all the great old shows starting January 1st. We're going to start running full episodes of the Johnny Carson Show with monologue, with, you know, all the bands, the interviews, the Stump the Bands, everything. It'll be a 10 p.m. weeknights on Antenna TV, and we're working on, you know, some cool stories. We've talked to some amazing people who were, you know, part of the show, friends with Johnny. That we'll have over the next couple of weeks, which brings me to where I am at this moment.
Where is that?
I'm in Ted Koppel's house.
Are you at Ted Koppel's house?
I'm at Ted Koppel's house.
How much hairspray is there?
Does Ted Koppel know you're in his house, or did you break into Ted Koppel's house?
That's the thing. He doesn't even know I'm here.
Oh, no. This is going to be bad.
Right.
I bet there's a film over all the mirrors because of all the hairspray.
Yeah.
I'm taking a couple of hair pieces and getting the hell out of here.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Why are you there?
Because Ted Koppel, you know, competed. Well, he was on The Tonight Show with Johnny. He was a guest a couple of times. But he was, you know, he was one of the few people that was ever actually successful competing against Johnny Carson with Nightline.
Right.
So I wanted to talk to him just, you know, about that, but also the side of Johnny Carson. When we think of the comedy and, you know, Aunt Blabby and Karnak and, you know, all the laughs, but Johnny Carson also sort of was the barometer of what the national conversation in the day's news was because of his monologue.
Sure.
You know, he would sort of set the tone of what people were talking about. So I thought, you know, kind of a news perspective on what Johnny Carson was would be important. And who better to talk about that than, you know, somebody who was competed against him doing a news show, but also knew him. So I'm looking at literally, I haven't counted. There must be like 25, 40 Emmy Awards.
For Ted Koppel?
Like his office area.
Yeah.
He's got pictures of every president, pictures of, you know, him and, you know, with stories that he's covered, famous places that he's been. It's an amazing, this is a museum, his office. It's a huge, huge office in, just in back of his house.
Dean, I don't know. I just want to say really quick, I don't know if you know this, but when they first came up with the concept for Nightline, it was going to be a show that would last a good long time. Their plan was, because this was during the Iranian hostage crisis, was just an update as to what was going on with the hostages. and they assumed that the show would last a couple of weeks and then they'd move on, but that didn't play out that way.
Right. It was just supposed to be a daily update on, you know, as we were counting down, you know, day number, you know, whatever it was, 147 of the hostage situation. And Ted Koppel would bring us up to date on, you know, whatever was going on with that story that day. Really, it was the sort of the beginning of, you know, the 24-hour news cycle of, you know, this was, you know, before there was a CNN, before there was a Fox News, before, you know, these, you know, cable channels that are littered with nonstop news now. This was one of the first, you know, sort of daily news shows about a particular topic. So, you know, Ted Koppel is, you know, historic in his way, and he has no idea what I've, you know, stolen and put in my briefcase.
My right watch now. Is gone on Nightline.
He comes back, he's going to find like four he's got like some, there, honestly, there's like, you know, 40 Emmy, you know, the statuettes, the Emmy Awards. He's got like 40 of them. Is he going to miss two
he's
of
them? He's not going to miss two of them.
Where is my shower cap?
He's not going to miss take his soap. I'm going to take his liquid soap.
Dean, what if he just had velvet paintings in every room? Wouldn't that be strange?
How awesome would that be if, you know, you walk in here expecting what I am looking at, this museum of news, and it wound up being like the dogs playing poker in cigars.
That'd be beautiful.
Elvis on velvet. Yeah. Like that. How awesome would that be?
That'd be fantastic. Now, we have to ask you a question. We know that you're very busy out there in California right now, and there was another interview that you may have had scheduled. Do you have time to take a break and then talk to us about movies, or do we need to let you go?
Well, I'm waiting. Ted's supposed to be here any second. So,
all right.
You know, let's try. If he walks in, I'm going to tell you that I got
to
go.
Or so, just hang up on us.
Yeah, just hang up on us. We're used to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. All right, that's cool.
And just hang up.
All right, we will take a quick break, and then we'll talk more to Dean Richards, who, of course, where else would he be? He's at Ted Koppel's house. We'll find out what's going on with the movies next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Make sure the doctor is on call, because this week Chicago's Best is deep frying their way through Chicagoland. I am in Chicago's Best Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV.
It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder along with Dean Richards. And as you know, whenever Dean isn't in studio with us over at Channel 9 at the TV studios, we ask that he talk to us live from Ted Koppel's house. That's where he is right now. Ted still...
Right now, I'm looking at a wall of his pictures. Ted Koppel with Yasser Arafat.
Wow.
With Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton, Mikhail Gorbachev. Let's see, who else is? He's got quite a few pictures of Kissinger. He's got a picture of him standing under. Do you remember those? There was that structure that was in Iraq.
Yeah.
That Saddam Hussein had of like the two hands.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Swords.
Yeah.
Him standing underneath that is a picture of that. What else?
Wow.
What else can I take you
How
on a little
impressive.
Tour of?
That beats all my blacklight posters and Miller light mirrors.
I got a Polaroid of me with Ronnie Woo Woo. That's all I have.
Oh, you win.
Right. I have a picture of me and Bob Bell and Roy Brown.
That's not bad.
That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
That's very impressive.
Right.
All right, so Ted is not in the room.
I understand. No, he's actually walking in right now, so I'm gonna have to take off.
Okay.
But let me just quickly tell you for the movies that are opening this weekend.
Yes.
A Christmas horror movie that's called Krampus. Krampus is an actual folkloric character, which is the opposite of Santa Claus. It's a character that comes to punish children that are bad, not reward children that are good, but punish them, abduct them, take them away from their parents, do evil things to them. And in the case of this movie, people are killed and murdered. You know, does anything say Merry Christmas more than that?
Nope. Perfect.
Really? It stars Toni Collette and Adam Scott, who was on Parks and Recreation. And it is, you know, it'll freak you out of how strange it is for a Christmas movie. So I gave this one a Dean's List C- on this. It's also not very well done.
Okay, Krampus
is bad. The
movie
that everyone's talking about this weekend is Spike Lee's Chirac, the much controversial Chirac that opens. And I think that this, you know, bottom line on this, I think it's just a huge missed opportunity. Mm. Spike Lee had the opportunity to tell an important a story about one of the biggest crises that Chicago has ever faced, the problem of gun violence in Chicago. And instead, he decides to treat the story in a comedic, satiric way, telling the story of the ancient Greek comedy in which women put on a sex strike to get their men to stop the violence. And that's what this movie is about. So in the middle of children being killed on the south side of Chicago are these wildly over-the-top comedic scenes that just seem so inappropriate to me. I mean, to me, it would be like doing a satire about 9/11.
Yeah.
Or, you know, something else which is so serious.
When I saw the trailer, I was shocked at what I saw. I thought it was going to, it really confused me. I thought it was going to be something so different.
Yeah. It's over the top. It's like, you know, circus-like in a way. Mostly I was so disappointed that there was an opportunity to really contribute to this conversation, you know, and try to, you know, shed some light, teach us something new, show us something poignant, touching about this very serious subject. I don't think it does that. So, one thing balances out another. Angela Bassett turns in a good performance. John Cusack plays sort of a Father Flager-like role mm-hmm. in the movie as a kind of a touching scene. But overall, I was hugely disappointed, and I'm giving this one a D plus C.
So neither film faring very well. Krampus is C-, Chirac is C. It's our friend Dean Richards live, of course, as always, from Ted Koppel's house in California.
Say hi to Ted for us.
We'll do.
Thank you, Dean. Travel safely. Thanks so much. You could hear Ted Koppel in the background giving him the wrap-up. Like, I'm here now.
Do you know who I am?
I'm Ted Koppel. Hurry up. You could hear that.
I got to push my hair down to get through the doorway. How can Dean make fun of him when he's in his house that he's going to interview him?
No.
Didn't you find that? Because when I said that, I thought, you know what? That was probably bad of me to say because he's going to interview him. Dean played right along.
You sparked him. You got him excited.
I love that guy.
I don't understand. All right. We'll take a quick break, and then we have a lot more show ahead.
It's Zuzu.
Zuzu from It's a Wonderful
Life.
She's here. Yep. Carolyn Grimes will join us in just a little bit right after the news. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Buffalo Gals, won't you come out tonight? Buffalo Bill, won't you come out tonight?
I might.
Do a little Jimmy Stewart?
There's a possibility, yeah. Carolyn Grimes is in studio with us, everybody. We know her, we love her, as Zuzu from It's a Wonderful Life, and she's appearing at the Hollywood Palm Cinema this Friday and Saturday to celebrate that film. HollywoodPalmCinema.com has all your ticket information. Carolyn, it's great to see you again.
It's great to see you, too. I'm so happy to be here.
You
I'm
look fantastic. Well, I hope you never get sick of anyone saying that to you, but you do. You look just magnificent.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. You know what? I'm getting older every year. I feel it.
Well, you know, when you were a sweet little Zuzu, you know, you knew right then you were just such a beautiful person, and you really are. You are so sweet. I really look forward to having you in the studio, although I forgot you were here last year. I thought it was 2 years ago.
It's okay.
Time flies. It flies when you get older.
Well, you know what? I just have to say that I really feel like I was given a door to be Zuzu.
Yeah?
And I opened it, and I was given an opportunity to have a really wonderful life, touching lives, and sharing this wonderful film with so many people. So I'm blessed. I really feel wonderful about that.
How old were you, Carolyn, when you got the role? You were 6 years
uh-huh,
old. So
yeah.
You do remember, I'm guessing, quite a bit of the filming and what it was like, yeah?
Well, I was a veteran. I'd already done 4 films before I did that one. So, you know, it was just a job.
Just another day at the office
it
for
was,
you.
Yeah.
If you wouldn't mind, let's start out with the director of the film, Frank Capra, who just made such a masterpiece of a film back then. What do you remember about Mr. Capra?
Mr. Capra was the kind of fellow that was very much a perfectionist, and he wanted things to be just right. But he didn't actually make you conform to the script.
Really?
You didn't have to do it verbatim, which was a real, it made for a very relaxed setting, and you weren't under stress that you had to say every word just so-so. It was important to him to get the thought out, and do it in the own natural way that you wanted to do it. And yeah. Man, that was great. I really like that. But I will never forgive him for not teaching me the words to Old Dang Zine.
You're still holding a grudge. I don't
she boycotts the song now.
At the end, I'm just mobbing those words. Blah, blah, blah.
So what, you asked him to or no?
Oh, no, no, just, no. Oh, I didn't even know. But, you know, as an adult, I saw it. And it
now
made
I gotta
me
go
just
back
wanna
and
cry.
Look.
Well, I don't think Jimmy Stewart knew the words either because he stops singing and laughs at me. So, you know, I don't know.
You saved him.
I think I did.
Kieran, it's hard for us to believe now because it's become such a part of the holiday season. But when this movie came out, when It's a Wonderful Life came out, it wasn't a big hit at all, was it?
Oh, absolutely not. It was a box office flop.
Yeah.
It sat on the shelf for 20-some years, and then they didn't renew the copyright in the early 70s, and that's when it became PD, public domain, and so then they started showing it everywhere. But I think there's a lot of reasons why it wasn't a success, and I think one of them is the fact that it was right after World War II, and people were wanting to be entertained. They didn't want to think. They didn't want to see a dark movie about a man who's going to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, it was released as a romantic comedy. Now, I don't think that was necessarily the case.
Yeah, I don't think so.
And also, it wasn't released until December the 20th at the Globe Theater in New York, and that was the first time it was out. Well, that's a little late for a Christmas movie. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. Yeah. So,
although back then, wasn't that about the time they released things? Because now it's like Christmas movies come out in October.
Right.
I mean, it gets earlier and earlier.
Yeah, well, it should have been a little earlier than that.
I guess that is pretty close to Christmas
Sinbad
time.
Sinbad the Sailor was the movie that was supposed to be the Christmas movie that year for RKO Pathé, and it wasn't ready. So they came to Frank Capra, and they said, we want you to get your movie ready real quick, and we're going to have it be our Christmas movie. And it was never meant to be a Christmas movie. It was supposed to be released March of 1947.
Hmm.
So,
all these little fascinating facts are in one of your books, aren't they? 'Cause
kind of.
You have so many books out.
Which is the book that kind of explores the history of the movie and you in it?
The one that I wrote is Celebrating It's a Wonderful Life, and that has quite a little bit of it. But there's a lot of good books out there that really, there's a Marie Cahill book, there's the Jimmy Hawkins scrapbook. There's a lot of, most of them are out of print.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good movies. Steve Cox had a really good book about the film. I mean, there's just so many people that take this movie into their hearts, and they just want to talk about it and learn about it. And it's just such a blessing to have this happen. It really is. Well, and this year, I'm also going to the Genesee Theater on Sunday. There's going to be a matinee and an evening performance. So I'm real excited about that, too.
You should be. Okay, so the Genesee on Sunday, two showings there at the Genesee.
Is that in Elgin, or am I making that
up?
No,
it's in Waukegan.
Waukegan.
And I'm also going to tell you that I'm also having the best experience, the Allied First Bank in Oswego.
Mm-hmm.
They
gave you free money.
People, well, they give people a second chance for a wonderful life.
Oh.
And they have a Zuzu loan.
How about that?
Isn't that
you have
incredible?
Made it when you have a loan named after
I
you.
I know. And it's got little wings on it. It's the coolest thing. Yeah.
Oh,
that ties in nicely. I asked you about Frank Capra and your memories of Mr. Capra. What about Jimmy Stewart? Was he as fantastic a human being as we all hope he is?
Yes.
He was. Good.
He was more than that.
Yeah.
He really was. He was the very best. He was his morals, his values, they were top-notch. He never got married till he was 44.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was a bone in his closet. He just really was a great guy. And he cared about his fellow men, which so many people don't. And he did a lot of things for his fellow men that he didn't necessarily get accolades for. Like today, so many people have to be patted on the back. Well, he did some things that were quiet. And, oh, I have stories. Fans have written to me many, many stories that he had really touched their lives in a great way. And I've talked to many of the men who served under him in the war. He was he ended up being a general, but he was a commander.
That's so impressive.
And, I mean, this man, he enlisted, so, you know, I mean, how great. And
you kept in touch.
Yes.
A lot.
Uh-huh, yeah. And all these men had such wonderful stories to say about him. I've never heard anything bad about him. Never.
You'd be hard-pressed if you looked at all the actors we've ever been lucky enough to watch in films. He's probably, if not the best, one of the best at playing both comedy and drama. He could do them both equally as well.
Yeah, but you know what? I like Cary Grant too.
I was going to say Cary Grant, Jack Lemmon, and Jimmy Stewart would be the three that were the best.
Those would be the three. Yes, they could.
Although
both.
Jack Lemmon, all I can think of him is Some Like It Hot with the dress. I can't get, because he actually looked like my aunt, which was kind of a slam to my aunt.
Oh dear me! Yes,
that's
it would
not
be.
Good.
That's God rest good. Her soul, Eleanor. Sorry.
Well, Tony Curtis wasn't the greatest either.
No, that's very true.
But Daphne really looked like my
aunt. Yeah, a little bit. Carolyn Grimes is here. Zuzu, you know, from It's a Wonderful Life, appearing at the Hollywood Palm Cinema this Friday and Saturday. That's in Naperville, 630-428-5800 or HollywoodPalmCinema.com. And then at the Genesee Theater, two shows on Sunday. Zuzu.net, Z-U-Z-U.net has all your information. We'll come back and talk to Carolyn more. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. You said hell in front of Zuzu Bailey, Wendy.
She's an adult now.
I guess so, but still.
Every time Wendy says hell.
Right.
My ears actually burned when you said that.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it hurts.
So it's awful.
Sorry.
We apologize. Carolyn Grimes is here.
I'll go to confession this weekend.
Zuzu from It's a Wonderful Life. A little behind the scenes, I don't know if you're aware of this, Carolyn. Last year when we did this radio production of It's a Wonderful Life, everybody here at the station played a role, and we had one of the guys who works here at the station was going to play the role of Zuzu. And Wendy said, you know, Carolyn Grimes, who played Zuzu, is going to be in town that week, the week we're doing the play. We should ask her. And we all went, well, she'll never do it. She won't agree to this to work with us. Oh. And you did it, and it was one of the thrills of all of our lifetimes.
Oh, I had a blast. It was so much fun to watch, and you were a great George Bailey. It was
you
good.
Were, Bill.
That's very nice of you. Very nice of you. Let's talk about, there's a scene in the movie where they're dancing on the floor in the gym, and then a very, very bad kid decides he wants to mess with everybody, and he presses a button, and then the gym floor opens, and everybody falls in the pool.
You would have been that kid. I know.
In real life, I would have been that kid.
Well, but George Bailey just took his girlfriend away from me. My gosh, right. He was getting even.
But that kid is somebody that we all know. I don't know if people realize it, but who was that kid?
That kid was Alfalfa from our gang.
Carl
really?
Schweitzer.
Yes.
Yeah,
I
Carl
didn't
Schweitzer.
Even know that.
Yes.
Yep.
You know, I have seen It's a Wonderful Life so many times. My kids have seen it like in bits and pieces, but this is the year. Maybe I should wait till next year. Next year's a special year.
Well,
huh?
Did you know that Ellen Corby was in the movie? Do you
from
remember
the
from
Ellen
the Waltons?
From
Grandma
the
Waltons.
Waltons. Yes, she's in the movie when there's a run on the bank. She's the little lady that comes up to the window and says, "Can I have $17.50?"
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
So I mean, it's just you know.
I would have given her the $17.50.
They bought the Waltons farm for that $17.50.
Yeah, there
that's
you
how
go.
They got the money. Now there's a scene in the movie.
It appreciated in value,
big time.
There's a scene where George Bailey is going to jump, and then the angel Clarence, of course, stops him. And he's so nervous, and he's sweating profusely. And I just read the reason he's sweating
I love
is,
this story.
Even though there's snow everywhere, it was sort of a warm...
95 degrees.
95 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was shot on the back lot, by the way.
Was it really?
So all yes. fake snow and all the whole
everything
movie or
fake.
Just that scene was
that,
the 90 degrees?
Yeah. Oh, no, it was 95 degrees for almost the whole 3 months that they shot the film. It was one of those weird hot flash things that
yeah.
comes around once in a while. So it was very warm. So they had to do a lot of night shoots and to keep the shaved ice from, you know. and the soap, you know, was in the movie. Ivory soap flakes were that
oh,
and fomite made up the snowflakes. So you see a lot of this terrible soap suds all over their faces when George is pulling Clarence out of the water. I mean, they can't even hardly see it there. It's soap suds are hanging all over.
I thought that was froth from the river.
No.
No. Oh, no, no.
No, that's soap suds.
Those are soap suds.
That's amazing.
The kid actors.
She needs to watch this movie.
I know.
We're
going
to sit down and watch
again
it again.
Here.
We'll see it again. The kid actors of later generations sometimes have a hard time adjusting to real life after they're done with movies or television. Was it a tough adjustment for you when you weren't a child actor anymore, Carolyn? Was it a tough move?
Oh, no.
No?
I don't think so at all. I discovered boys.
Oh?
And I like that a lot.
That could have an impact.
Oh,
I can
yeah.
see where that could have an impact. With your mom and dad, what was their idea? Like, once you were done with films, did they say, now, and at some point, we're going to have regular life? What was that?
Oh,
move?
No. My mother got sick.
Oh, she did.
She started getting sick when I was 8. And she continued on down the road. And so you need a pushy stage mom, really, to get
sure.
you out there and everything. And when she wasn't there, I didn't have as many parts or wasn't, you know, so active. And so gradually, you know, my life became different. And then she died when I was 14. Mm. My father got killed when I was 15.
Good Lord.
So the court in Hollywood sent me to a little town in Missouri. There were 800 people in that town. And I used to listen to the top 10 on WGN in that town.
You did?
I did.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Wait, can I ask, how did they decide? Did you have relatives there in Missouri? They
went to live with my father's brother and his mean wife.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting situation.
Oh. Now, did you miss it? Did you want to be
At first, for the first year, I thought I died. I thought I had gone to hell. Mm. I really did. I just thought it was horrible. And then I began to realize the Midwest people. This was a town of 800 people. I'd gone to school with the kids. There were 900 kids in my high school class.
Yeah.
In this town, there were 36 kids in my high school class.
Jeez.
And they were, you know, farmers.
Yeah.
And I had to learn a whole different life. But these people were so genuine, so sincere. They knew I was in a terrible home situation. So the merchants, the teachers, I had real friends. I learned about real people.
Yeah.
There was no artificial. There was no superficial like there is in Hollywood. It was
real.
And I learned about love. And I thought, wow, this is something that I really don't want to leave.
Right.
So I ended up going to college, and I became a medical technologist.
You did. Mm-hmm. Good for you.
Never went back to Hollywood.
And stayed in the Midwest.
Yeah, for a while.
And then she got sick of us.
Yep, that's the.
Well,
happened.
I stayed there for a long time. I've been living in Seattle for 16 years.
Oh, all right.
So. But still not back to L.A.?
No.
I'd never live in L.A.
Here's a scenario. Let's say you're up one night and you're just flipping around the dial. TV's on. You don't know what you're going to come across. And all of a sudden, the movie's on. It's a Wonderful Life. Are you captivated by it? Do you sit down and watch it? Or do you say, I've seen this 100 times. I know what's coming. I don't need to do this.
No, I don't watch it.
You don't watch it anymore?
Oh, I do watch it all year long.
Oh, you do?
For my appearances.
Oh, you do? Oh, yeah,
sure.
I guess.
I sit down and watch the movie with everybody. Yes, I do. But when I'm at home and I come across a movie that I've been in, there's only one that I really like to watch, and that's Albuquerque with Randolph Scott and Gabby Hayes.
Yeah.
I had a really cute part in that movie, and I like that one because I don't get to see it very often. But see, It's a Wonderful Life. I see it all the time.
Yeah.
I see The Bishop's Wife all the time. And
isn't that it with Cary Grant?
Yeah.
Isn't that
a great movie? If it's an obscure movie, then I probably would watch it, but not so much the ones I get to see all the time and have DVD of and so forth. So I like John Wayne, Rio Grande. I would watch that one.
That
I kind of
work?
Have fun with that. Yeah.
What about The Godfather? We came across The Godfather. Because I can't
pass
that.
I've never looked at horses in the same way since that movie.
Her name is Carolyn Grimes. That's her real name. We know her best as Zuzu, and It's a Wonderful Life. And you're going to be at Hollywood Palms Cinema this Friday and Saturday night. That's 352 South Route 59 in Naperville. Go to HollywoodPalmsCinema.com. And you can also go to your website, Zuzu.net. Mm-hmm. I want to know who took the Zuzu.com.
Who took Zuzu.com?
We don't know. Don't
I'm going to find that person and make them give it back to you.
I think it was your uncle's evil wife.
I think she had something to do with it. We tried to get that one, but didn't get it, so we had to go with Net. And that's been years ago because I've had that for a long time.
It still works.
It totally does.
Find.
And then the Genesee Theater in Waukegan. When are you going to be there?
I'm going to be there Sunday.
Well, you're going to get a lot of hanging with people who just adore you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a blessing for me. I mean, I get a lot of love heading in my direction. So how can that not be wonderful?
It's the best. Yeah.
All the guests today have just been positive and uplifting. Gary Hoey, you know, gives till it hurts. Carolyn Grimes just loves people.
Right.
And she liked boys.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing.
Oh, I did.
Not so much anymore.
Your husband, by the way, has a strange reaction to that. Every time you mention that, I'm watching your husband in the corner of the room just react strangely to that. Very, very peculiar.
But it's so nice in this first half of the show to have some positivity, really, with our guests today.
Absolutely.
Because
really
there's just so much going on in this world. So what a great weekend to go see Carolyn Grimes and escape for a while and feel that holiday spirit.
And get the inspiration and love that comes from that wonderful film. There's so many messages of good. And you want to be careful. You don't want that blackbird flying in on your shoulder.
Yeah.
That's so true.
It won't get off my shoulder. And I think, oh, it just left something on my shoulder.
Carolyn, so great to see you again. It really is. We hope to see you again soon. And thanks for being a part of one of the greatest films ever. It's a Wonderful Life.
Thank you for having me. I always enjoy coming down here. You guys are a hoot.
Oh, you're the best.
Thanks so much.
A quick break, and then we'll find out what Steve has coming up next. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Welcome back. It's Bill and Wendy part deux.
For all of our French-speaking listeners.
It makes more sense to say part duh.
Doesn't it? Part duh. That sounds better. I like that. Jump in at any point during the show at 312-981-7200. There's something I started to tell you off the air, but it now makes more sense to tell you on the air because I've had a second occurrence of this. We've talked about strange dreams on the show before, and we've tried to sort them out. And I told you the last time we talked about dreams that I have this thing going on where not in every dream I ever have, but more times than not, while my dream is happening, I'm cognizant of the fact that it's a dream. I say to my, like, if something really horrendous is going to happen in the dream, I say to myself, well, it's not going to hurt you. You're in a dream. Let it happen.
That's called lucid dreaming.
Yeah.
And you are much like the human version of Harold and the Purple Crayon. If you don't like what's going on, Harold would just take his purple crayon. Like, if he got in trouble, he would draw a boat and then water, and then he'd sail away. So you are much like the human Harold.
Oh, well, I guess that's a compliment then, isn't it, kind of?
Yeah, oh, it totally is.
A couple of weeks ago, I had a very strange dream where I don't even remember the specifics of this dream, but when I woke up, Terry said to me, well, that was quite a night. And I said, why? What happened? And apparently, and I only remember very small bits and pieces of this, I tried to bite her almost in zombie fashion, in Walking Dead type fashion. I tried to bite her, so much so that I pulled her arm up and I spaced my hands out on her arm, and she showed me the mark on her arm, and I was completely asleep during all this.
I still question the fact why she let you bite her.
Oh, she didn't let. That's what stopped it. Is she demanded that I not bite her. She didn't want any of that.
Well, you don't demand. Please don't bite me.
Please,
you
sir.
Like whack someone in the head or
she
slap.
She screamed my name to try to wake me up.
But you're dreaming, so it wasn't you in your dream. You were Daryl.
I guess it was. I think it was Walking Dead related somehow. But
was it a Sunday night into Monday morning dream?
No, I don't remember what night of the week it was. But now, I started to tell you this the other day, and now I've had a reoccurrence of this.
Not about one guy.
Yeah.
I don't like him, and that's where it started. I came in whining about him.
Most of the bad dreams I have, and I don't, most of my dreams are extremely pleasant. Almost all my dreams are very, very happy. But every once in a while, I do have a nightmare, and normally I like them because it's like I'm seeing a scary movie. So I'm like, this is great. I'm sleeping, but I'm also watching a horror movie. I love this.
And you can be like Brian De Palma and change the way it's going.
I do. It's the weirdest thing.
I don't know how you do that.
But I say to myself, as somebody's about to attack me or whatever, I go, this is a dream. Make this happen. And then it just happens, right? It's great. All right. Well, twice this week, I've had a reoccurring dream. A lot of times when I have nightmares, the theme somehow of the nightmare, and I'd say 90% of the time when it's a negative dream, this is what it is. Somebody is trying to break into my either house or apartment or wherever I'm living in the dream.
Sure, because you've lost the keys.
That part's true in real life. Somebody's trying to get in and either take things that I own or attack my family and myself. It's always somebody on the outside trying to get into wherever I am.
What else are they going to do when they break in? They're gonna
hurt us or take our things, right? They're not going to tickle me. That wouldn't happen, would it? In a dream.
Elmo would if he broke in.
Right, that's true. All right. So on Sunday into Monday and then last night into today, I had almost the same exact dream where a very specific person was tunneling from my front door underneath to try to break into my house to harm my family and steal my things. And in both of those dreams, the person that was doing that, who was tunneling and trying to steal my things and hurt my family, was Mickey Rooney.
He would totally do that if he was alive. He's like the mole man.
I can't for the life of me figure out.
Because he wasn't a nice guy.
Well, we interviewed him. We had him on years ago, remember? And
no.
he was surly. But it wasn't the kind of surly where I went, you know what? In 16 years, I'm going to have nightmares about you trying to break into my house and steal my things. Why in the world would I select a guy? And Mickey Rooney's no longer with us. He had a great acting career for many, many years.
And he died a very poor
sad death.
And that really makes me sad. But, you know, it shows you that if you're not a very nice person.
It comes back to haunt you, evidently.
Karma, baby.
I know. But my wife this morning, now the one Sunday and Monday, I didn't remember any of. She said to me, you were yelling in your sleep. You weren't just talking in your sleep. You were yelling at your sleep. And then last night,
Mickey Rooney.
She said
get
to
away
me, I was yelling,
me.
Mickey Rooney, don't harm my family. Mickey Rooney, stay out of my house. Don't try to dig a tunnel. I'm yelling things. I'm screaming at Mickey Rooney in my dream.
Will Terry please start taping you when you sleep?
Does any of that? Well, do I want that to happen?
Yeah, we do. I don't know that you do, but we would like to hear it.
That could be used in court. They could use that as evidence in court.
Can I just say, you are not very efficient in your dream, because if you, like, you, Mickey
right.
Rooney, don't harm my
right.
family. It'd
be better to, I know. I
get
know.
Out of here, you jerk.
Right.
Don't harm my family. Quit right. digging a tunnel.
Right. Man who used to play Andy Hardy in a series of films in the 1940s and had a brief but memorable romance with Judy Garland. I didn't have time to get all that out. But it just, and maybe I'm trying to be too logical over something you can't control, but like all the
you
way
you can
to,
control it, you say?
Normally I can. I could not control my Mickey Rooney nightmares. That's what's so frustrating to me, is normally I would just say to myself, you don't want to have a nightmare about Mickey Rooney. Stop doing this. And I
bring
would.
Bring in Pat Paulson.
Bring in Pat Paulson. I, my hands were tied. I couldn't do anything about it.
By Mickey Rooney?
I don't know. He didn't break. I luckily stopped him both times, just shy of him getting in. But it's so vivid. Like, I could see, there's part of my living room, and I could see the floor, like, caving in where he, and I could hear him, like tunneling under. Why would I spend that much effort on something that's so ridiculous? It just, Mickey Rooney would never harm my family or me.
I don't believe that. I think
he has no
he
interest
might.
In hurting us.
How do you know that? Didn't you get him angry when we talked to him? Maybe he is haunting you.
I remember asking him something, and I don't remember what the question was, but he was really, this is years ago, this is 20 years ago, he was extreme, and we were told by people who had interviewed him in the past, Mr. Rooney doesn't mess around. If you ask him a question he's not happy with, he won't be your friend, and that's kind of what happened. But I'm not holding a grudge. That was 20
Evidently
years ago.
Evidently he is. He's haunting you from beyond.
I guess he is. What would start that? Now, you said to me the other day when I started to tell you this, well, Mickey Rooney is going to be on TV because he played Santa Claus in one of those Rankin Bass.
No, I came in and said to you, it has officially started. We watched, the boys who were watching Santa Claus is coming to town, and I said, I hate Mickey Rooney.
That's right.
And then you go, it's so weird you say Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
Because last night.
I had a nightmare about him.
But I didn't know it would be a recurring one. You're a lucid, recurring dreamer.
I guess I am. Here's another weird aspect that I just remembered. When I dreamt about this Sunday night into Monday morning, it was regular Mickey Rooney. But then in the one last night, even though the rest of the dream was in color, Mickey Rooney was in black and white as he was trying to. Or no, maybe.
I'm not kidding.
Or because in my head, the Mickey Rooney of in my head is in black and white movies. So even though my world was in color, his part of it, because he was, you know, in those old movies, he was in black and white. It's just so stupid that he'd be in my dream, not just one, but two in a week. Like one, you go, oh, that's a fluke. But as two, you know, two in that many, in that short of a time?
You do realize our break's over.
Oh, are we on the air now? Sorry. I would never waste anyone's time with this nonsense.
Why don't we try and get, we know some people at the School of Metaphysics. Let's try and find someone to talk to.
They
have that dream
good.
Hotline every year, but let's have them on
can
now.
Can we get them on? I would love to understand
Kevin,
this.
School of Metaphysics right here in Chicago, we should have some contact. We need to find out the Mickey Rooney syndrome.
Why do I have this dream? And normally you say, does anyone else have a similar dream? Nobody in the world is having nightmares about Mickey Rooney tunneling under their yard to get into their house to harm them.
Maybe Judy Garland did.
Maybe she did.
Before she
maybe
passed
that's
away.
It. Yeah, that's it. All right, there's a lot going on in today's show. I've reinforced the doors to make sure that Mickey Rooney doesn't break in at any point during the show.
It's like Mickey Rooney playing the part of El Chapo.
Yes. Yes, it is.
You would be a good director.
I know. All right, a whole bunch coming up. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Stupid little dreamer.
I'm embarrassed to say that twice this week I've had the same dream. It's really, it's beyond a nightmare. It's terrible. I'm yelling in my sleep. I'm screaming. I'm kicking. I'm mad at Mickey Rooney because, as it turns out, in my nightmare, Mickey Rooney is tunneling from my front yard underneath my house.
To harm you.
To harm me. and my family and steal our things.
That's what people do when they break in.
I know, but you would think a guy like Mickey Rooney would have more sense. Why would he do something like that to me?
There was a study, 224, although the second time you dreamt about him, he was the only thing in black and white.
He was in black and white. The rest of us were in color.
living color?
Like a Technicolor.
Okay.
Nice color.
224 says there was a study done that suggested when TV was in black and white, a lot of dreams were in black and white. So it's not weird that he was in black and white, because that's the Mickey Rooney
that's
you
like
better.
That's how I think of Mickey Rooney normally, is like Boys Town Mickey Rooney, when he was Whitey Marsh and he was in black and white.
Maybe that's it.
Do you think that's it?
No.
Could be.
630 says maybe Mickey Rooney is haunting all the people who ever made him mad. It's just your turn, which means ultimately we're all going to have a dream about Mickey Rooney.
After the first one, and I even said to you, I go, it's too stupid to even talk. It's just dumb to have an idiotic dream like that. But I've had it twice in four nights now. Almost the same exact dream, except that it was in black and white.
But just Mickey.
Yeah, everything else was in color.
That's strange. Very Wizard of Oz-like. Oh. And Judy Garland, there's your connection.
Oh.
Look at me.
You're on a roll. You got it right. All right.
All right. 224 might have it worse than you. I dreamt that I was flying with a half-robot Mel Gibson while the Army was shooting at us.
That's weird.
What would bring... Listen to you.
Well, comparatively, maybe not, but just like when you have a dream like that, don't you try to figure out what could have caused that? What happened to me that made that happen?
Somebody said, 708, don't forget that one of Mickey's wives, Barbara,
yes,
was murdered.
Yes, that's true. Mickey was married many times, and one of his wives, Barbara, was murdered. That's very true.
I think it's his fifth wife. I'm not really sure.
There was a poem years ago, and I don't know where I read this. It was, you know the poem St. Ives? As I was going to St. Ives, I met a man with seven lives. And then
yes.
Somebody wrote this poem, and this might sound quite weird and loony, but that man was Mickey Rooney. Do you remember that poem? I don't know where that was. Was it Mad Magazine or something? That sounds like Mad Magazine.
Maybe the Brandmeier Show.
Oh, could be. Could have been. I don't know.
I don't remember that one at all. But lucid dreaming is what you are capable of, and I'm almost a little envious.
I have the ability somehow to know normally, if it's not a Mickey Rooney-related dream, that I am in a dream, and if something awful is about to happen, I can make it not happen because I go, it's a dream. You don't need this. And then I just cancel it. Normally, not always.
Every other time but Mickey Rooney.
Well, most of the time.
All right, because lucid dreaming means dreaming while knowing that you're dreaming. The term was coined by Frederick van Eeden, who used the word lucid in the sense of mental clarity.
Yeah.
Lucidity usually begins in the midst of a dream when the dreamer realizes that the experience is not occurring in physical reality, but is a dream. How do you figure that out?
Have you never had that?
No.
I don't know why I'm aware of it, but it, you know, like the common dreams, like that you're trying to walk up a staircase or run up a staircase because somebody's chasing you and the stairs are like an escalator and they're coming down. You've had that dream, right?
I've actually been on an escalator.
Oh, you've had that happen? Someone's chased you?
But it's like you go to scream and no noise comes out.
That's a common one. Whenever I go through any of those types of dreams my whole life, I've just had the ability to go, yeah, but it's a dream. If you really needed to scream, you could scream. I just somehow I know it's a dream.
Well, then why can't you stick your spirited finger out of your dream and tap yourself on the shoulder and wake yourself up?
I don't know.
This is getting very
I'm
much.
Not
did you ever
sure.
watch Adventure Time?
No, what's that?
It's a cartoon that's really freaky, and that's what I just thought of.
Oh,
like,
they have that ability to do that.
Well,
in there?
It's everything's kind of like an acid trip.
Oh,
and yet it's meant for kids, sort of. Strange world we live in. But
yes.
I could just see yourself trying to wake yourself up if you're able to.
I don't wake up from them normally. I just say to myself, hey, nothing to worry about. Those tigers aren't real. You're in the middle of a dream. Let it play out. But I don't wake up. I just go, it's a dream. Those aren't real tigers.
Are you going to donate your brain to science?
Science fiction. They're more interested in it than science.
All right. Well, lucid dreaming, you can do it. This realization that it's a dream and not physical reality is triggered by the dreamer noticing some impossible or unlikely occurrence in the dream, such as flying or meeting the deceased. So something triggers you to then go, that's preposterous.
Yeah.
And then you're able to change it. But everything in a dream is like that.
Sure, because it's all just abstract. I mean, it's based on something that you know, because it's your subconscious providing all those thoughts. So it's based on something you know.
Yeah, but it's like when you dream, like, I was in my house. To me, it's never really my house.
It's always a little different,
yeah.
Right? Just a little bit different. Yeah.
Sometimes people become lucid without noticing any particular clue in the dream. They just suddenly realize they're in a dream. A minority of lucid dreams, according to the research of LaBerge and colleagues, about 10%, are the result of returning to REM sleep directly from an awakening with an unbroken reflective consciousness. So you wake up and go right back into the deep REM sleep? Is that what they're saying?
I'm not sure.
Do you dream about Michael Stipe?
Not often, no. What you just said about how the reality is a little bit skewed. When I was a kid, I had this dream. It was right after we moved into our house. And in the dream, it was everybody who was in my family at the time, my dad, my mom, and my brother and I.
And it looked like them, and you could recognize
everything
them?
Was the same except, and I'm trying to figure this out. Good luck on this one. Throughout our entire house, you know those things they have sometimes at hot dog and hamburger places where it's too silver? They're like bun warmers, and you can move half of it up or half of it down and take a hot dog bun and then close it again.
I know exactly what you're talking
about. Those were all over our house in every room.
Keeping the White Castle hamburgers warm.
Maybe that's what it was. But what would have provoked that? Why would I want to have bun warmers everywhere in the house, in every room? And I remember saying, like, in the dream, I'd talk to my mom, and she'd go, "Well, you can. It's, you know where those bun warmers are? Yeah, it's behind the bun warmers." Like, everything we talked about had something to do with the bun warmers all throughout our house.
You're a piece of work.
I guess. Why doesn't Mickey Rooney steal those? I don't need a thousand bun warmers. Have
no one
at
else
them,
does
Mick.
Either.
Nobody needs that many bun warmers.
All right, you know what's just as weird? Industrial musicals.
Yes, yes, yes,
Have
yes.
you dreamt about one of those ever?
I've not, but Steve Young, a former writer for David Letterman's show, has put together a great documentary about them, and we're going to talk to him after the news. It should be good. Stay where you are. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Bill, I got to tell you something. I watched a little trailer that I have no idea what I just watched.
You have no idea? Really? Well, it's a strange concept. The concept of industrial musicals is something most people are probably not aware of. I wasn't until we found out about Steve Young, who joins us on the phone right now. Steve has quite a pedigree behind him, a 25-year veteran of writing for some of the funniest shows on television, including The Late Show with David Letterman and The Simpsons. And he's got a documentary that's going to be shown at the Music Box Theater tonight. Steve, thanks for being here. How are you?
Oh, hello. Thank you very much, Bill and Wendy. I'm great. I just got into Chicago, and I'm raring to entertain.
Excellent.
I just watched the trailer for this, and of course, you can go see The Lost World of Industrial Musicals tonight at the Music Box Theater. I was very impressed by the dancing Meisterbrow beer can. That made
sure.
me very happy. But are these really, like, legitimate films that companies showed their people?
They were done in earnest, and they were exclusively for these in-house corporate audiences, dealers, salesmen, distributors, executives, industry insiders. They were often meant to be humorous, but now, decades later, we're watching them with completely different eyes and different contexts. They are out of this world, surreal, and funny in ways that they were not originally intended to be. And the dancing beer cans and bottles clip that you mentioned that's glimpsed in the little trailer, that has an impressive pedigree also. That's from a Miller Beer distributor show that was put on and directed by future Tony winner Susan Stroman, who, like so many showbiz and theater people, cut their teeth and honed their craft doing these private corporate shows. And she got together with me. I talked to her and interviewed her, and she brought me a stack of DVDs that just made my mouth fall open because this is the stuff you and I were never supposed to see and hear. And now we are digging it out of these dusty crevices of American history.
And they, Steve, to be honest, they spent quite a bit of money. Sometimes the budgets were up there, weren't they?
Oh, it was a staggering amount of money, especially the golden era, I call it, the 50s into early to mid 80s. Post-war U.S. economic might meant that so many big companies were flush with cash, and they wanted to entertain their sales forces at conventions and meetings. They wanted to entertain them, but more than that, motivate them and educate them about the new product lines and the new marketing strategies. And it turned out that musical theater, of all things, was a tremendously effective way to do all these tasks at once and people would come out of these shows feeling energized and bonded together as this team that was ready to march into a brighter tomorrow. And, yes, go out and sell the new Plymouth and sell the new John Deere tractor and sell bathtubs and silicone products and a thousand other things.
Yeah, I saw the silicone products. Here at WGN, we have a lot of team building, a lot of things we do together as a group. And you do walk out of there feeling really good.
Sure.
A whirly ball tournament that went on. But, boy, I think we could put together a really good musical.
Better than these, yep.
It's unreal.
Well, Steve, that's what I think most people don't understand is not everyone can be Rodgers and Hammerstein or Andrew Lloyd Webber. It takes a certain talent to be able to write a full-blown musical, but that didn't stop any of these people, did it?
Well, some of these folks who were writing industrials never became household names. I mean, just the luck of the draw and how you end up in life. Some people worked in industrials for a long time and made a lot of money doing it. The money was terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
People that you have heard of worked in industrials and used it as a training ground and launching pad. One of the very early ones that I discovered when I was starting by collecting the record albums, which were pressed in very limited quantities just to give out to people who'd been to the convention or the sales meeting, I found a Ford Tractor dealer musical from 1959.
Wait, and stop and listen to what you just said, Steve.
Ford Tractor musical.
Music. I mean, please.
Yep.
All right.
You don't think that would have mass appeal?
We may actually have a clip from that somewhere nearby.
Kevin, do we have a clip from that?
The
Golden Harvest. You might have that one.
All right,
Golden Harvest coming your way. Gotta hear this.
Let's see if we can find that. Let's. Here it is.
All right, it's coming up now. I mean,
now.
Now-ish, in the next few minutes.
Ford. Yeah, I threw him a curveball. That wasn't fair, but...
Well, Steve, while
I can sing it, my
no,
yeah,
don't sing.
Ahead.
Oh, do you want to sing it? Wait, he'll find it. But while Kevin's looking for it, I just want to point this out.
Right.
I remember seeing you. I know you were a writer for David Letterman's show for The Late mm-hmm. Show. You were on the show, weren't you, about a year or so ago, talking about this sort of thing?
Yeah, when the book that I co-authored came out 2 years ago, and it grew out of my work on The Letterman Show. I'll tell you that history if you're interested. Dave Letterman, of course, very pleased that someone on his staff had taken this outside project.
Yeah.
He said, oh, we'll have Steve on. He'll talk about it. And I think he figured, well, it'll be a one-shot deal. We'll show the book. We'll talk about it. He's going to play a couple clips from his bizarre corporate records, and that'll be fine. And
yeah.
After that show, which went very well, that segment, a lot of fun, and Dave enjoyed it, and the audience loved it. Dave said to me, you know, that was so terrific. I think we should make this a recurring feature. So I actually ended up coming back a couple times with more records. And
that's great.
Bizarre audio from corporate sales meetings and so on.
That's
it was
great.
A lot of fun.
And what's the name of that book? We can find it at steveyoungworld.com.
Yeah. Steveyoungworld.com will probably point you toward it. The book is called Everything's Coming Up Profits, the Golden Age of Industrial Musicals. Everything's Coming Up Profits, of course, coming out of a parody of Everything's
Coming up Roses.
All right.
And a terrible, terrible show for a floor tile company borrowed that song and turned it into Everything's Coming Up Profits.
Beautiful.
All right. And you had mentioned the Ford Tractor musical. Does it need a little more setup, or shall we just play it?
Well, I'll tell you why this one is significant. I did not understand when I was first finding these things, big names from the world of Broadway to look out for. I knew nothing about this field of real, legitimate musicals. It took knowledgeable friends to point out the credits on the back of this Ford Tractor record. My friend said, do you understand who these people are? Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock, those are the guys that wrote Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah.
Here they are 5 years before that, kind of building up their songwriting muscles by doing these corporate gigs, and they did this Ford Tractor musical.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of it. Kevin, play that. This is the Ford Tractor musical. I think you'll enjoy it. Listen.
Turn your tractors and implements to a bumper crop of dollars and cents. Gonna be a golden harvest in 1959. Gonna be a lot more buyers to sign the dotted line with the new Ford tractors. The future's looking fine.
That would be a hit today.
I like it.
I think people would love that.
I could have had a huge career in industrial musicals.
Oh, sure.
Well, it is a lot of fun when you hear that sort of jaunty music and you realize from the lyrics, this was not something for the public. It was all firing up the salesman to get more people to sign the dotted line and all that. But these were very hard assignments oftentimes because you were handed specifications and binders of material from the company brass about here's what you have to put into some songs for the big sales meeting show. And you would get these batches of data and corporate product specifications. And if you were not a talented lyricist and songwriter, you would be in over your head. But Sheldon Harnick, the lyricist from Fiddler on the Roof, who's now 91, and I've gotten to meet him and talk to him, he said he loved doing these things. They were challenging, but they were very satisfying. And, of course, he, at the time, as a struggling young creative type in New York City trying to make it, he was so grateful for the money, which was substantial. Yep. And he actually told me that when he was starting to get success on Broadway just a few years later, part of him said, oh, no, I hope this doesn't mean I won't get to still do industrials. He had become so fond of this strange little genre that he did end up having to leave them behind. But we do have the Ford Tractor musical. But there are some that are so densely packed with information about the product line specifications that dealers needed to know. I think we have one from a Monroe Calculator show from 1969.
Oh, sure, the Monroe Calculators, of course.
Yeah, it's a classic, and they were introducing the new models, the 1260 and the 1265, and boy, these guys trying to fit all this data into these songs must have been just sweating bullets.
All right, let's hear a little bit of that. Hold on, Steve. Yeah. Kevin has that one ready. Here's this is from Monroe. Listen and enjoy.
And here you have the 1260.
With this business machine, they can't compete. There's value here they cannot beat. With Monroe exclusives through and through, it will build up tremendous sales for you. So small, so light, and compact, you see. With MOS LSI circuitry.
Wow.
But no
deep.
Square root key.
No square root key back then. Well, these are all,
it
Steve.
That goes on for about 5 minutes, by the way. That is a musical desert to cross if you're a songwriter trying to get to the end of that song. But boy, some of these people that I've talked to, it just seems like unsung heroes to be able to take those assignments.
Of course. Yep.
Here's a great idea. Go to industrialmusicals.com. You have some clips up there, of course, your book, Everything's Coming Up, Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals, Steve Young and Sport Murphy. And get a little taste of it, listeners, and then head over to the Music Box Theater. Tonight is the night, because, boy, this is something that you can't recreate anywhere mm-hmm. else. When's showtime?
I believe tonight the doors open at 7. Show starts at 7:30. I've got a handful of one-of-a-kind, only-known copies in the world, vintage film from the 60s and 70s from several of these different productions, including a number that come from Chicago. I have found out over the years, Chicago was a huge hub for this stuff, and some of my very favorite shows and pieces of film are Chicago-based.
Perfect. Steve, it was great talking to you. And I just want to tell you, incidentally, how much I miss watching The Late Show with David Letterman. There's a lot of great guys doing late night talk shows right now, but nobody did it better than David Letterman. You were part of that, so you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do. And he had a flavor that I don't think we'll see again.
Nope, so true.
Well, why don't you go over to his house and just show him
show him the finished
video,
product.
You know?
He's seen a fair amount of this stuff. I do hope that he'll come out to one of my shows one night. Do you have time for one more clip from one Chicago show that you
actually
know
we
about?
Do not. We have to take a break so we can get to news on time. I apologize for that. But
all right.
musicboxtheater.com, also steveyoungworld.com. Best place to get tickets for tonight would be just show up or go to the music theater box office.
Yeah, I think there'll be walk-up theater tickets. What am I saying? I think you can go to the theater and get a ticket.
Excellent.
And if you want to buy it head online, that'll work fine too. But I look forward to seeing the aficionados of the weird and the twisted.
Perfect. They will be there. Thank you, Steve. We appreciate it. Have a good time tonight at the Music Box.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Thank you very much, Lindy.
Absolutely.
It's Steve Young, everybody. Musicboxtheater.com or his own website. That's steveyoungworld.com. We'll be back after this. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Thanks again to Steve Young, comedy writer for both The Late Show with David Letterman and for The Simpsons, and his movie The Lost World of Industrial Musicals will be at the Music Box Theater tonight. Just go to musicboxtheater.com. They have all of your ticket information.
Somebody just texted 312. I sent a text yesterday about my brother whose major money-making career was writing industrials for major corporations.
Oh.
Many came out of NU, Northwestern University, mm-hmm. including my brother. Then somebody says there's a huge accident on the inbound Stevenson near LaGrange Road exit. Traffic backed up for miles. And
we'll keep an eye on that, I'm sure, in the traffic department.
Yes, Dolly McCarthy will have more on that. Earlier today, Steve Cochran was talking about the Dell guy.
Right.
The Dell computer guy.
He can't stand him.
Well, I almost hate him more than Steve does, I think.
Oh.
He, you know, when you're watching the Blackhawks game, which I will be watching tonight, puck drops 6:30, I think, early
game.
Yeah,
pregame's at 6, right.
I hate this Dell guy, and he really, in my opinion, looks like Leonardo DiCaprio. Does he not?
He's got a similar facial structure to Leonardo DiCaprio, yeah.
And Leo had a beard for a while, right? For some things?
Had for a while, and I think does have again. I think I saw a picture of him recently with one.
Well, that's because he's in a grizzly bear movie.
Yeah, he plays. He doesn't play a grizzly bear, but he's in some movie about the outdoors.
Did you see the trailer for this?
I have.
It's
very violent.
It looks like a movie that I wouldn't expect to open on Christmas weekend.
Do you know the name of it? I can't remember the name of it, but I have seen clips from
The Revenant.
The Revenant?
Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be up for an Oscar for this. Leonardo DiCaprio is battling a grizzly bear, and there's been tons of rumors going around that he was sexually assaulted by this grizzly bear.
You mean his character was in the movie, not that Leonardo DiCaprio was, right? What do you mean?
Yes.
He was or his character was?
Well, his character. What do you mean?
Right.
I said he's in this movie battling a grizzly bear. Why would Leonardo DiCaprio be into a grizzly bear?
I would
bear?
Hope that wouldn't happen to anybody.
I would hope the Dell guy would meet a grizzly bear in the forest. And
now, you say that, but if that happens to that guy,
bad.
You would feel awful. So I hope that doesn't happen.
This film, The Revenant, is based on a novel of the same name. Tells the story of frontiersman Hugh Glass.
Yeah.
So based on a true story, Glass was attacked by a bear in 1823 in South Dakota, nearly died, but it makes sense. It was a female bear protecting her two cubs.
Oh.
So if it's a female bear in the movie, why are there reports all over the place, started by the Drudge Report, that this bear assaulted Leo's
I don't know.
Character.
I don't know the answer to that.
It's a female.
Is it to sell tickets? Do people want to see that on film? I don't want to see that.
Who would want to see that?
People are weird. They want to see weird stuff. I don't want to see
Yogi
that.
Bear might want to see that.
Maybe.
The bear in the book is a female, and
in the book, The Revenant.
Yes.
Can I admit something to you? I have no idea what that means.
I'm looking it up now because I don't.
What does The Revenant mean? Yeah, I think whoever is in charge of the titling department should always pick a title that people go, oh yeah, I know what that means. Because if I hear The Revenant, I have no idea what that means. It's like Remnant. It's like Revlon. I don't know what it is.
Well, I'm gonna tell you. All right. Oh, this is interesting.
What does it say?
It is a person who returns as a spirit after death, like a ghost.
Okay, that's better.
Even the ghost would be better.
I think that's taken.
The ghost without Mrs. Muir.
Right.
The spirit, the revenant.
The ghost that did not have a weird encounter with a bear. Although he does have an encounter, but it's not as bad as...
Yeah, but it looks pretty intense.
Yeah, it does. Oh, yeah, it does.
And it's based on a true story. I don't see this as being, you know, a holiday movie for the whole family.
Right.
Revenant.
Revenant.
Revenant. The
Revenant.
Password. The password is Revenant.
Revenant.
A person who returns, it's a noun, a person who returns as a spirit after death like a ghost.
That sounds cool.
It's from
cool.
the 1820s to 1830s, so is the movie, that's why they named it...
The Revenant. Right.
Which, of course, I lost when I needed it.
But someone's going to have to stand out in front of the theater and explain it to people as they walk past. Because if you're looking up at a screen and you go, wow, there's 9 movies that I could see, but I don't know what that one means, you won't go in that one. They got to hire a kid to just stand there and go, it means somebody who's returned with a ghostly spirit. Blah, blah, blah,
so they're a big like sandwich board, Revenant equals
right.
ghostly spirit.
Yes. I think that will help sales of tickets.
And is this alleged molestation by a grizzly bear helping or hurting the movie? Don't you wonder sometimes when movies are coming out and there's a big hubbub about
sure.
something? Is it the movie company? I know. I think Fox is behind it. And they're saying, no, there was no molestation. Nothing was going on.
Right.
But don't you wonder who, because now everybody's talking about this.
Right.
A day or two ago, I heard nothing about this
movie.
But
now it's popular.
And I didn't know what Revenant meant.
So you're smarter just for being involved. You're better off. All right.
That's what we do with our show, Bill.
I know. We educate. We'll take a quick break. We've got the news. Kim will give you the news, and then we have a lot more show coming your way. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Can I congratulate not one, but 2 winners, Wendy?
Yeah, and then can you tell people why there are 2 winners?
I'd rather not.
Well, I'd rather
I don't
you.
Think it's important that why
it's
there's 2 winners.
Very important.
We want to congratulate not one, but 2 winners.
You want to congratulate.
Pete is going to win a fabulous Tree Time tree, the black and red desktop tree.
Is that Pete from Wheaton?
Pete from Wheaton. Peaton. And then Mark, who is not from Wheaton, is the other winner of our fabulous Tree Time red and black desktop tree. Listen, keep listening to us.
All right. First of all, you're not very good at giveaways. Do you know that?
No,
you
I'm very good at giveaways.
For the
As
listener,
turns out,
for the
I'm
station,
extremely good at giveaways.
There's a memo being typed right
I
now.
Know that. Evidently, when you do a contest, what you're supposed to do is it has to be very uniform. If you say the first time caller number 9, I guess according to the rules of society, you have to say that the second time caller number 9. You can't say caller 11 like I did. So instead of having 1 winner on today's giveaway, we have 2 very fortunate winners.
Oh, they love you.
All I can do is give and give and give, Wendy. That's all I have
it's
in me.
It's the Christmas spirit. Zuzu was on. Gary Hoey was on playing right. Christmas music. I know that you just feel warm inside.
The holiday has just overtaken me. Plus, I got Mickey Rooney trying to break into my house. And I had a weird episode with a bear that I'm not comfortable in talking about on the air.
And the funniest part was, I thought I heard you say caller number 9, and then when you reiterated, you said 11, yeah. And then I asked Kevin, what caller is that? And I thought he put up 10.
Right.
So, but Kevin 10 was never mentioned.
No,
you
but
said
Kevin
9.
Is great at math. He averaged it out.
Yeah.
He goes, well, he said 9 yeah. one time. He said 11. Let's make it caller number 10.
And I'm over here, like, busy with calls, so I heard the 9, and I
right.
said, okay.
Yeah, I did too. I wrote 9 down.
Nine,
and then
I thought nine. I heard an 11 also, yep. and I got confused.
It's confusing. That's why. So I'm sorry, everybody. I just want people to be happy. I thought, why have 1 winner when we can have 2?
You're such a rebel.
And that's what I did. It's very rebellious. It's very James Dean.
it is so James
so
Dean.
So James Dean, his spirit lives on in me. It really does. I'm like one of them revenants. Have you heard of revenants? I'm like one of those with James Dean's spirit.
Revenant.
Yeah, I'm one of those. Here's a story, and I think I know how you're going to react to this. I think I know you well enough to know that you're not going to react the same way I've reacted to this story. There's this woman named...
Because I'm nice and you're not, it turns out.
That, I don't think that plays into it. There's a woman named Katie Leach. She lives in Idaho. She decided to have dinner the other night at a local diner. It's called the Texas Roadhouse. So she doesn't go by herself. She brings with her her 10-month-old son. Her son... being a 10-month-old kid doesn't react the way you'd want somebody to react in a restaurant. There's a diner. There's a lot of screaming and crying and carrying on, and sometimes, you know, 10-month-old kids will do that sort of thing. So here's what she receives during her meal. Katie Leach is sitting there at a table. She's got the kid. The kid is acting up a little bit. So somebody, another patron, comes over and hands Katie a note, and the note says these words, "Thank you for ruining our dinner with your screaming kid. Sincerely, the table behind you."
I hate, and I know hate's a strong word.
Hate is a very strong
I
word.
I hate the people at the table behind her.
The ones who wrote the note, you hate
How
them?
How dare they do that? Do they not have kids? Is their life so perfect?
How do you think the story ended? What do you think happened after this?
If I was Katie
this?
Leach, I would have punched them or punctured their tires. I have a lot of vitriol
that's
lately.
That's drastic.
I just, how rude of people.
It ended with the people who wrote the note being told to leave the restaurant.
Good.
That's how it ended.
Bill, what, you think it's okay for that couple to give them the note?
I'm not sure a note in this particular instance was appropriate, but I could see where, although you pointed this out, it's a diner. It's the Texas Roadhouse. Isn't that one of those places where there's like peanut shells and stuff on the ground?
I think so. And I think, you know, they get up, the wait staff gets up and dances maybe. Regardless, it's not a Linea where you're paying $5,000 for a plate.
It's not your grade A restaurant. But it's kind of a casual dinery place. But I might have said to the lady, is there any way you could just get the kid to be a little bit quieter?
You really would say that? Honest to God.
If the kid was being really obtrusive, really loud, I might consider it.
Shame on you. It's not the Bill Leff world.
No, I know that. But let's say it was a special occasion. My daughters were really good in restaurants.
You know what?
They really were.
My kids cried, and either Jim or I would take them outside and try and calm them down or do something or let them walk around.
But she didn't do that.
Is she there by herself?
Yes, because no man would have her. Because her kid was too loud.
You have completely negated your screw-up giveaway where you were showering listeners with love.
I may give away more trees before the show's over. Who knows?
You would really say something to someone?
I would say... I've told you this before, and you got mad at me when I told you this, but I've done this on several occasions. I know you are. Relive the madness with me. Sometimes in a situation where, remember when we worked, there was another station. I'm not going to say the name of the station, but the initials were WLS. And there was a parking garage next door. And sometimes, even though we were parking in that garage, you couldn't get parking. It was just like this time of year around Christmas. Even though we had parking spots in there, they weren't assigned spots, so you just couldn't get a parking spot.
Yeah, it was filled.
All right, so sometimes when I would go into work, there'd be somebody who would decide, I'm going to use up two parking spots. They would park in the middle of two parking spots.
Well, that's an intentional thing.
It's intentional, but in a situation where there aren't any parking spots left and you have to drive around and drive and you can't find one, I would sometimes leave a note on the door saying to them, sometimes with saltier language than other times, hey, could you try to be a citizen of the world and not use up two parking spots when somebody needs one?
I don't care about that.
Chevy Monza is parked diagonally between two spots. I don't know. And no one can park thanks to you.
I agree with that one.
Your friend, Wendy Snyder, I'd write your name on it so
you
I wouldn't
are
get in
a
trouble.
Jerk.
So
you know what? I bet you did.
Who would do that? I might have. So what I'm saying is sometimes you leave a note as if to say...
Yeah, but this is a human kid crying that, you know what? Kids cry sometimes when they're 10 months old.
Right.
And I bet your kids cried at 10 months old at one point.
They did sometimes. They were well-behaved in restaurants. I don't know why.
Because you guys don't cook. You were in restaurants since they were born.
Yes. Maybe they were born in a restaurant. They were born at Zavaro's.
Better than Sybaris.
Way better than Sybaris. They were conceived at Sybaris. They were born at Sbarro's.
All right. I don't want to hear more about these stories.
All right.
You're going to get a note from your wife.
But what I'm saying is sometimes a note, I'm not positive this is one of those times, but sometimes leaving a note saying, hey, come on, be a team player. Sometimes it's not the worst thing in the world.
Sometimes you can't do things about it. Have you ever been in a situation where your kid is crying and you're doing everything you can to stop them from crying and they still cry?
No.
I don't believe you.
I don't remember that ever happening.
Then you're living in your lucid dreams.
I'm very lucky.
Ron, go ahead. Disagree. Whatever. It's your world and Bill's world. We're just renting space in it.
Hey, Bill, Wendy. This is Ron from Midlothian. How you doing, Bill?
How are you, Ron?
Good. I used to talk to you a lot over that, of course.
Sure, of course.
Wendy, I love you. Love your viewpoint on a lot of things, but you are dead wrong here. And you are looking at the glass as half full. It's like you're not even looking at the glass totally.
You're smoking the grass, Wendy. That's what you're doing.
That's why I don't get into fights with people and give them notes.
Okay, a couple of things. Number one is, and I did, maybe it doesn't go into details, but what you got to, and I'm not overanalyzing this, but you got to see what was going on. First of all, what were the ages of the kids?
10 months.
How much?
10 months old.
One kid.
Okay. Was the baby throwing things? Were the parents making an attempt to hush the baby? Where did they take the baby out? You got to understand something is that there's different situations. Now, if you were sitting on a plane next to a screaming infant, would you feel the same way, Wendy? Be honest.
I would say, God, I wish this kid would be quiet. But you know what? No. I wouldn't do anything because what can they do? Hit the ejector seat and get the crying kid off the plane?
Well, one thing they can do is very, very logical, and that's one of the problems with society. Is they could say, I am so sorry about this, but, you know, at least apologize to the people in the next
How do we know she didn't do that? Because that would be me, and Bill, you know me better than anyone. I would
know. Did they?
Here's what she did. She wrote a note back saying, now keep in mind the original note was, thank you for ruining our dinner with your screaming kid, sincerely the table behind you. So then Leach takes out a piece of paper and she writes this. His new thing is yelling. I'm doing my best to teach him his indoor voice and to not yell back at me when telling him no, but he's only 10, almost 11 months and still learning. We all tried quieting him down with the majority of the time. All he did was get more excited around all the commotion.
How about that, Ron?
Well, I'm going to leave you. Well, personally, what I would have done is, out of the utmost respect, I would have said that, you know, it's a shame. I would have, you know, at least apologized or would have maybe taken the baby out or whatever. I mean, babies are babies. We know that. But like I said, there's different circumstances that we don't know. Maybe the kid was screaming right in the person's ear. We don't really know that. But I'm going to tell you a really quick story. I was in a restaurant. Really quick. Years ago, I was in a restaurant, and this is before you had iPod. This was back in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And a smart transistor radio, I was listening really quietly to the Bears game, and the people know I frequented this restaurant all the time. There was a guy with some kids, they were screaming, toddlers, and he literally says, can you do me a favor and turn that radio down, like if it was blasting? It was very, very low. In fact, the waitress didn't say anything. So I says, I'll tell you what. I says, I will be more than happy to do that. I will turn my radio off if you turn that, you know, quiet your kids. He looked at me, and it was a big touche. You know, sometimes people, the world revolves around them.
I think the world revolves around that person giving a note saying, thanks for ruining my dinner. When the mom is saying, we are teaching him that no means no, when he doesn't get what he wants and he has just started yelling, he's only 10 months old. I'm sorry. I mean,
you don't think the right way to play it is take the kid out of the restaurant, walk the kid around, maybe calm the kid down.
I would do that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I would never, Ron, I got to let you go. Bill and I are arguing. Thank you for calling. I would try and do that. And you know me, I would give the look to the people in the restaurant going, sorry, guys, man, you know, and I would walk out with the kid.
Yeah.
But if the kid was still crying.
Then what?
It's life.
I think
I have every right to be there with my crying kid. And my kids were really good in restaurants, too. Honestly,
what if this was more than one table? What if everyone around is like, and I know this was just a Texas Roadhouse. It's just a diner. It's not a big, big, expensive holiday meal with, you know, with money really being spent on this. But what if everybody was disturbed by this kid? Would you still feel that way? What if five or six tables all around this kid's table is like, come on, lady, you got to take the crying kid out of the restaurant. Does that make a difference?
I don't think it's anybody's business. If you're near this kid and it's crying and bothering you, ask to change tables.
Oh,
life happens, Bill.
Yeah, but at some
point... I don't ask to move when you start crying during our break. And sometimes you're loud.
You keep showing the notebook during the break. I'm going to cry. It's very sad. All right, we've got a lot of people with some varying
thoughts. They're all siding on you. You're all a bunch of meanies.
They are all on my side.
I know. It's like you don't care about it. Fine, all you kidless people who have no hearts.
312-981-7200. That's only for the people who agree with me. People who agree with Wendy, just dial 6. Give
You're
us a call.
Jerk.
We'll take your calls next. It's Phil and Wendy on WGN. Just let us catch you up very, very quickly. Katie Leach brought her son, 10 months old, to a Texas Roadhouse. It's a diner in Idaho. She received a note from the people next to her that said this, thank you for ruining our dinner with your screaming kid. Sincerely, the table behind you. Leach was somewhat taken aback by this. Turns out the restaurant kicked out the people who wrote the note. Not Katie Leach, not
good
her kid,
for the restaurant.
But the people who wrote the note. What are your thoughts on this 312-981-7200?
All right, Tony, what do you think? And we got to be quick here.
I think that, you know, for one thing, Texas Roadhouse isn't just a diner. I know that you independently wealthy people eat at other places.
No, we didn't say it's called a diner. And
they described
it
as a diner in the story. So I don't.
And I know what it's like.
I don't think. I think she should have taken her baby out. Because, you know, people are trying to eat dinner, and when my kids cried, I took them out.
Yeah, so did we.
I like that. And if she wants to practice the indoor voice, do it at home.
I'm standing and applauding.
All right. Hopefully you don't sit next to anybody and they cough loudly or something. Hi, Dave.
Hey, this is line six.
This is line six, yes. Do you agree with Wendy?
I agree wholeheartedly with Wendy.
How come?
As a father of six.
Holy crap. You were busy.
Each and every one of them is different, you know? Not every kid works the same. And I will tell you this much. I have been places, and I've had people next to me or around me who have had kids that have acted up, and the parents were getting really irritated. Well, I have stepped up and said, hey, you know, me and I need a break. Why don't I, you know, sit with the kids if you don't mind? I can sit with the kids for a few minutes while you take a break and relax. And who knows, maybe the kid will calm down. Why not? You gotta step up and do something instead of always making a bad angle on it, you know?
I kind of agree with you. Like, if I was sitting next to this kid that was crying, I would find myself trying to, like, get the kid's attention and make goofy faces. I really would,
yeah,
to try and help that kid from crying. I would agree that taking the kid outside would be a good move.
Don't you think?
I would have done that. But how do you go out 15 times? It's just embarrassing for the parent. And the more I think about it, this has happened with us. And we've ended up, I think, with our first son, Michael. And I think Jim and I said, you know what? We'll take it to go. Could you wrap it up? And we left.
Now, that's the way to play it.
But it's embarrassing. And, I mean, sometimes you do the best you can.
Yeah.
And parents with a baby have a right to have dinner, too.
Without a doubt, but
Thanks, Dave.
I can see writing a note to express to them.
You know what? Grow a pair. Don't leave a note. Why do you leave a note?
Because that would hopefully let them know that in the future that other people are being inconvenienced without creating...
So say it face-to-face. No, why leave a note, you chicken?
Because then, if you say it face-to-face, then you have the possibility of some sort of a brawl. And this, what this does is it gets the message across...
In a very rude
way. You say to the waiter, hey, here's an extra buck. Could you please just hand this to those people and I'll make this noise, whoop, 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 and run out of the restaurant while you do. But it prevents any kind of confrontation beyond what needs to be. It just says to them, the next time you're thinking about a situation like this, realize that other people are being inconvenienced.
You guys are a bunch of meanies.
No, we're not being mean, but that one lady's satisfaction of having her kid with her could have ruined potentially a dinner for everybody around her.
Only ruined one other woman's, so it's one-to-one.
Only one that spoke up. You got to think there's other people there who are like, ugh, all right, this is what we're in for the next 45 minutes. Have you never left, like in a restaurant, have you never left your table because there's people nearby that are just causing some sort of commotion? You go, I can't enjoy a meal with those people just that close. You've never done that ever?
No.
No?
And I've had annoying people. You just kind of realize you're not in your living room. You're not in your house. You're out in public. And sometimes you sit next to jerks.
We were in a restaurant. Do I have time to tell you? I do not. I'll tell you off the air and then...
What good is that going to do?
Hey, I missed out on the story. Just very, very quickly, about a year and a half ago, we were in a restaurant, fairly pricey restaurant. We knew that for the two of us, it was going to run us about $80 or $100. We were near a group of four people where there was a guy and a woman. Two of the four people were as loud and as obnoxious as could possibly be. They were just nuts. So for 10 minutes, we sat through it. And then I said to Terry, this is not going to be a good meal. She goes, I don't think so either. So we said to our waiter, look, when another table opens up, let us know. And we sat as far away from as we could. So that was
good
the way we
you.
Handled it. Because it's like...
If it would have bugged you, then you did the right thing.
Right, right.
I mean, everybody should do what makes them happy.
Right.
And including going out to dinner with a baby.
Right. Even if it's not your baby, just get a baby, have a baby ready. We'll take a break. We've got the news.
We got to fill so much stuff into a short time.
We have Harry Lennox, who is in the movie Chirac. He's going to join us after the news. And Alex Stone is going to give us an update on everything that happened in San Bernardino, California. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
It's a big day in Chicago tomorrow. Chirac opens. And I saw the trailer for that. And I'm going to see it. I don't know how I'm going to feel about it, but we are going to talk to someone who is in this movie right now. And he plays Commissioner Blades in Chirac. We are talking to Harry Lennox right now, live from the set of The Blacklist. Harry, how are you?
I'm doing well, Wendy. How are you doing?
We're great.
Anxious to talk to you again. Harry, when you got the call, you know, they were casting Chirac and you get cast in it and it's very exciting. Did you have any idea in those early days that it would be as controversial even before it opened as this movie has been?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was anything to be upset about, you know, in terms of the name. It's not, you know, so we didn't see that coming. We thought that it would be, well, I can't speak for anybody else, But I didn't see where anybody would have any opinion other than to be grateful that somebody was putting the spotlight on the situation there and trying to bring attention to it.
Now, it's based on a play. That's what everyone keeps saying about, you know, women withheld sex from their husbands or boyfriends until they became unarmed and stopped a war. And loosely, this is based on that?
That's true. Yeah, the play is by Aristophanes Lysistrata, written, I think, in 412 B.C. So, you know, Spike took that situation. And you know, I know of other people who have done trailers or stories updating Lysistrata, that as a means of stopping a war, the fighting,
right?
That the women would use their power, or at least, you know, one aspect of their power, to appeal to the men, you know, to stop what they're doing. So it was also something that was tried in Liberia. I can't remember. I think maybe 2011. And it helped bring an end to the war there, you know, what was going on at the time. So it's, you know, a satire, but it has, I think, resonance today. And I'm aware that somebody named April Lawson in Chicago has started her own strike, her own sex strike, if you will. And,
yes.
And several women have joined her. So
I had heard about that. And I see, to me, this is way more artsy than I expected it to be. I almost expected it to be a dark, gritty documentary type film. So I was a little shocked when I saw the trailer, but I still want to see it.
Yeah, I think that like any good movie, you know, it'll make you laugh, it'll make you cry, it'll make you think. It's provocative. At some point, you know, you have to take an approach to an artistic movie, to a narrative. You have to decide if it's a tragedy or, as you say, a doc, or, you know, what tone it will have. But, you know, I mean, life goes on in Chicago. Life goes on in war zones. There are, you know, people fall in love, fall out of love. People, you know, laugh, they cry. You know, that's so we didn't want to remove all of the humanity or all of whatever levity that could be found in it, and we thought it was a good approach to a very difficult subject.
Harry, you spent a lot of years here in Chicago. What do you make of the violence that we've seen, in particularly the last couple of years? It's really been a rough stretch for us here in town. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think it's indicative of what I've observed. Whenever you remove infrastructure, when you remove resources, when there's no jobs to be found of any real worth or value, when you remove all of those things, crime will follow. I don't think that's anywhere different over the world, around the world. If you take the water out of, you know, Yemen or whatever, some other place, you know, people are going to start warring over that. If you have oil fields on fire and that's the only means of trying to get money or what have you, or pirating, you know, so at sea, what the Somalis sometimes do, you know, you have to, so when there are fewer resources, people are going to use whatever means are at their disposal to try to control those. And I think that a real answer would be getting, and we suggest this in the film, you know, getting the companies, the Fortune 500 companies, to put some merchant, to put some industry back onto the south and west sides of Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, it's shocking. I think that Chicago is about a third of the population of New York, but there are fewer murders here in New York. And
yeah,
it's not exactly, you know, Eden over here.
Right,
so
sure.
But what are they doing right that could be followed? What's going on in Los Angeles, which was a war zone? What have they done right between communities, organizations, and law enforcement being able to work together to redeem neighborhoods? So they're doing something better than what's happening in Chicago. And I think that, you know, we need to take a very critical look at it. But I think that the reasons that is happening are what I just talked about.
You know, we had this woman, Tamar Manessa, on the air with us, the founder of Mothers Against Senseless Killings, MASC. And she was getting out on a lawn chair in the summer, sitting around and seeing some of these gang members. And she would come up to them and hug them because she was showing them that, you know, someone cares about them and personal touch means things. And to talk to her, and actually we should get her on the show again, because to hear her speak about when you have no job to go to, there is no place to go get food, you can't succeed, you have nothing to gain in the area you are, I can see where life could become hopeless and maybe doesn't matter as much.
Absolutely. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, the expectation of a long life, of any sort of, you know, viable longevity, is itself, you know, sort of a remote idea to a lot of people. And you know, you got a great city like Chicago where, but, you know, as we talk about in the movie, in some sense, it's a tale of two cities. You see a robust and thriving downtown area, North Sides, and all these great stores and industry come into the city. And then on the South Side and on the West Side, there's nothing. It's like a desert.
Yeah.
It falls off quick.
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
It falls off very quickly, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. And you know, why can we put in all of this money to people who don't necessarily even need the money? Why are all the resources going into certain areas and not going in the other areas? Our tax dollars are you know, taxed and assessed at the same rates as everywhere else over, or, you know, in the city. But, you know, so, I, you know, honestly, it needs a very objective look, a very objective view. And I think more than anything, that's what Chirac is about, the film. It's comprehensive. It's not just talking about the violence, but it's talking about all the other reasons that that can be predictive,
right,
of violence and what things will follow. So,
Harry, we will be looking for Chirac in theaters tomorrow, and we can't wait for The Blacklist to return. That comes back in January?
I believe it does. I'm not exactly sure what date precisely, but yep, we'll be back on the air in January.
And
we're
shows. And they're also using all scripts written in 412 BC on The Blacklist, correct? Is that what they're doing?
That's right.
Harry, great to talk to you. We're looking forward to the movie again. Chirac comes out in theaters tomorrow. Have a good time, Harry. Have a great holiday season.
Thank you. You as well. Great to talk to you again.
Okay,
take care. Thank you, Harry.
Harry Lennox.
Bye-bye.
We'll take a quick break, and then Alex Stone checks in from ABC News with an update on everything happening in San Bernardino, California. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN. Bill, yesterday when we were on the air, news was breaking that San Bernardino was under attack.
Yeah.
And the very first question I asked you was, do you think this could be terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of discussed it a little bit, and it didn't seem like San Bernardino would be some spot that, like, ISIS per se would attack. But more things are developing, and ABC News correspondent Alex Stone with us right now. Hi, Alex.
Hey, guys, and the FBI is trying to figure out that exact question right now. The priority here in San Bernardino is figuring out, was this terrorism and was there anybody else behind it? A priority here is getting digital media evidence, computers, cell phones, thumb drives that were found in the home of the attacker, Syed Farouk, and his wife, to an FBI lab in Washington, D.C. They want to go through that, try to figure out who had they been communicating with. Was this something they decided to do on their own? Or was there a terrorism element to this, which more and more it is leaning in that direction, but they are not sure quite yet. They left remote-controlled bombs inside the center here. They had more at their house. Those bombs made by the specifications laid out in an Al-Qaeda online magazine. We know that they had traveled to Pakistan in recent years. The FBI wants to know, what was he doing in Pakistan? Was he training? Was he communicating with terrorists? Or was he doing something else? His wife was here in the U.S. On a Pakistani passport. A whole lot of questions right now that the FBI is trying to answer.
Alex, I've heard people debate back and forth what exactly constitutes terrorism. Does that mean that they're with a sanctioned group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda? Or are they acting alone? Where do we have a common definition of what exactly would constitute terrorism?
You know, it seems like the FBI is right now working on, were they attacking on behalf of a religion, of some overall ideal that they had, that would be terrorism in this case. That
right.
If they were doing this for the Muslim religion, for Islam, for a group, you know, any of those, then they would say that yes, this was terrorism here. We don't know at this point if any of that is true. This may have been workplace violence, although it seems like at this point there was a lot of planning that went into it. That yes, he attacked his coworkers, and there were reports that he was angry and left the event that he was at. Now, police say he may not have been angry. He may have just left the event and disappeared. Some of his coworkers say, well, he was there in the meeting, and then he was gone. Others say, well, he seemed angry and got up and left. But if you're angry, you get up and leave. you go outside and your wife happens to be there with AR-style rifles and bombs that can be remotely detonated and tactical gear, seems unlikely that that was just by chance that he could get angry, walk outside, and all of that was waiting for him.
See, that's what scares me, is it seems like so much went into this planning. Syed Farouk was an employee at this company. Had he been recently terminated or demoted? Do we know anything about that?
No. He was an employee at the County Department of Public Health, and they were having, some have described it as a holiday party. The Department of Public Health says no, it was training and meetings that were being held and workshops that they were having, that he was sitting at a table when he got up and left. But they say he had been a good employee for the past 5 years. They say in the meeting he seemed perfectly fine yesterday, that until he got up and left, he had been partaking in discussions, and he was sitting there very calmly. But apparently he was about to get up and do something that only he and his wife knew was about to unfold.
And someone had made some reports that they knew of this couple or lived near the area and saw some kind of suspicious activity, but didn't really want to report it because it's sometimes people will call you a racist or something if you say, you know, there's this couple next door and they're doing some weird things. I mean, do you know anything more about that?
Yeah, police, and some of this is being done by police, some is being done by the FBI. The FBI is now in charge of this investigation, which is uncommon in a mass shooting for the FBI to come in and take it over. Typically, the locals are still in charge of it, but because of the national security aspect of this and the potential that this was terrorism, the federal investigators are taking over this case. But they say they have heard those reports as well. They're checking on them. They don't know if they are anything. There are a lot of rumors and reports floating around right now. There was a report earlier today from an unnamed cable news channel that was running reports that the attackers had GoPro video cameras on and that they had recorded this whole thing. The FBI says absolutely not. They have found no sign of any GoPro video cameras, any video recording. They say that was completely an erroneous report. And there's been a lot of that, of names last night of the suspects that were being released by very official-looking news outlets that turned out not to be. So everybody's being cautioned here by the FBI and police to be careful, that everyone's trying to run with it first, and a lot of it is turning out not to be right. And a lot of the rumors that people who live in town will tell you, hey, yesterday when all of this was going down, I had a guy come up to me and say, I saw them running around in camo. They were running around my neighborhood jumping through yards. No, they weren't, because they were in a chase, and that just happened to be where the chase ended, a vehicle chase where the gun battle happened. They were not jumping through yards, and they weren't wearing camo. So there's a lot of different stories floating around here right now.
And three people were mentioned. Is it now, at this point, only the two?
Yeah, police and the FBI now believe it was only two. It's quite common in mass shootings for people to see more suspects than there actually are. In Columbine, there were reports of five or six different guys in Aurora, Colorado during that shooting that people thought two or three guys had walked into the theater. It was one. Last week in Colorado Springs, police for a long time were looking for two gunmen. Turned out to be one in that case. Here, they had initial reports of three. They've gone back. They've looked at surveillance tape. They say it's clearly two people. They have talked to witnesses now that things have calmed down, and they say that they do believe it was two. People may have seen the shooter multiple times or seen police rushing in and thought it was a shooter. Could have been any number of things, but they say it's only two. They did detain a guy last night while they were searching neighborhoods, but they said it turned out he had nothing to do with it. He just happened to be in the neighborhood, but then they have held him because he had an outstanding warrant, which that is that guy's unlucky day that he happened to be walking down the street. Yeah. And they detain him for potential terrorism,
yeah,
and he's not involved in it, but then he gets nabbed for that warrant.
Alex, the two gunmen weren't on any specific FBI watch list. There was no awareness, no general awareness of either of the two gunmen, but people they associate with are on FBI watch lists, correct?
Right, and they were not on a list locally, not on a list federally, but potentially some of those that they have hung out with or had discussions with could potentially be on one of those lists. And that's what the FBI is trying to figure out right now. What was their communication with some of these other people? Was it something that could have indicated that something like this was going on? You know, they have a six-month-old child that they dropped off at a family member's house yesterday, and very nonchalantly and very just like any time you drop off your kid to say, I got to go to an appointment.
Yeah.
They dropped off the baby, said, we've got a doctor's appointment. We'll see you later. And they were coming here to carry out this attack.
A poor child who is now an orphan.
Yeah.
And there have been reports that I've seen as well that Fareed was born in Chicago. Any truth to that?
He was in the Chicago area, the FBI believes. He is an American boy, but he of Muslim faith and of a potentially Pakistani background. They're trying to figure that out right now. On his dating website that he had before he got married, it talks about that he loves snowboarding and loves working on cars, and he loves guns, according to his website, that he was a gun enthusiast. But you look at that and would have no clue that all of this was going on behind the scenes.
It's a tragic story, Alex, but as you know, one that just keeps happening and happening. It's just awful.
Yeah, man, but this one definitely much more bizarre, much more complicated, potentially a bigger implications for what this could mean, but these shootings definitely do keep happening, and you know, in the last week, we've covered Colorado Springs. We've now covered this one. It is one after another.
Horrible.
We're hoping to remove the phrase active shooter in 2016. If we can do anything to help with that, Alex Stone, please let us know.
You got it. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Alex, thanks so much. It's Alex Stone from ABC News. We'll check in with Roe and Anna, find out what they have coming up next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.